This is Dark Matter with your host, Art Bell.
Extra.
Now, here's Art.
Terrestrial radio, he says as he interrupts his own guy. How you doing, everybody? It's a brand new week. I'm Art Bell. Glad to be here. Going to be quite a ride tonight. Lloyd Auerbach is going to be our guest. And it's going to be really interesting. But I've got a number of things that I want to do before we get to Lloyd. Number one, you know me, I'm a geek, right? And incidentally, I've had everybody asking me, Art, do you play your own music? Or do they play it for you?
Actually,
this guy named Evan. In case you call and you get a guy who answers your call, that'd be Evan. And no, they, Evan, does not play my music. I play my music. In other words, not much has changed over the years. I've got my own board, all my own bumper music, my own announcements, if you will. And so I control virtually everything here. Evan controls the phones back there and sends it from Washington, D.C. to New York to the satellite or whatever, however it happens. But I am kind of a geek, and so I happen to notice that one of my computers, supplied by them, was hooked up to my board. And it's got a fader attached to it, meaning I can bring my PC up on the air from here. Now, we've got a really cool number, as you know, 855-REAL-UFO, but it's only good pretty much in America, and now thanks to the manipulation of Sirius XM Canada. So if you're in America or Canada, you can call that number. But if you're in the rest of the world somewhere listening,
well, God knows how.
I know it gets around. If you're somewhere else in the rest of the world, you have no way to get through until now, maybe. So I put Skype on this computer. Now, I'm not making any promises at all. However, I do have a Skype account for the show. So if you're somewhere in the rest of the world other than America or Canada, you can call right now because I want to test. Somewhere, I don't care where you are, in Asia, Europe, South America, whatever. Give it a try. If you can hear my voice, I'm going to give you my Skype ID right now. It's also on the website. It is art.bell51. That's me. That's my Skype ID for the show. art.bell51. And if you're out there somewhere in the middle of wherever, you know, I've actually got a good friend in Bangkok, in Thailand. I'm going to have to tell him about this. Let me give it one more time, and you can try it now anytime. If it rings, I'll pick it up, and you have to guarantee me. Now, if you're in the U.S. and Canada, don't call it. This is just for overseas people. Although, you never know. We might use it for something else occasionally if it should happen to work. That's the big one, if it works. art.bell51. That's me. So if you're out there somewhere, give it a shot, and if I see it ringing, I'll pick it up. Okay, stuff. The Ghost Picture Contest. It's beginning to get pretty wild out there, and we're getting a lot of ghost photos, and they're up at artbell.com. So I guess first and foremost, I would say go take a look at the ghost photos. A lot of them are probably lame, but some of them are pretty good. So take a look. Moreover, remember we've got a contest going on, right? A contest. So if you have a ghost photograph, you could potentially win a Sirius XM radio and a one-year subscription to Sirius XM. That's a really serious prize, and we're going to let the audience judge which one is the winner. Come on, Skype people. Art, A-R-T, dot, as in period, Bell, B-E-L-L, 51. Art, dot, Bell, 51. Ghost stories. We are petitioning all of you for ghost stories. I would like a synopsis of your ghost story and a phone number. And if I get it, come spooky matter, that would be on Halloween, we will call you. Oh, I am getting calls. That's interesting. All right, well, keep calling, and if I can see you, I'll pick it up. Isn't that interesting? Okay, I hope this is somebody in America. I'm going to give it a try. It's an experiment. Hello there. They hung up. Probably not out of the country. Come on, folks. Abide by the rules. This is for people outside the U.S. Now, where was I? Ghost stories. Yeah, that's right. So, I need your ghost story in brief and your phone number, and then we'll call you on Spooky Matter Night. Now, Sirius XM is now working really hard on the 1001 error that many of you have been getting. You know, try again later, that kind of thing. Occasionally that does pop up. So, they've gone to work on it, and they're, you know, as many of you log in, I know many of you have followed us over, and you're listening on the web. Gee, look at this. How am I ever going to... Okay, well, it's hard to tell. It's an experiment. The whole Skype thing is an experiment. The government at this hour is still closed for repairs. All day long it's been deal or no deal. Are we going to have a deal? Well, so far, no deal. The debt ceiling is the big question. You know, this government closed thing is one thing. The debt ceiling is completely something else. And I'm going to tell you how serious it is for me. I contacted my banker in the Philippines about, you know, transfer. I'm quite serious. If they go to default, I'm out of here. Because I'm going to be absolutely honest with you. If they really let this go, first of all, they'd be out of their minds insane, because then the rich guys would lose their money too, I think. You know, I've been trying to think of this in every way that I can. But it does seem to me that the rich would have as much to lose as, well, maybe not quite as much, but they would lose by percentage of very, you know, a whole lot of their money. So they'd be out of their minds to do this, and I just can't believe they're going to let it happen. But I've got my eyes out, and I think things would go to hell in a handbasket. I'm trying to be... Here's a Skype call. Dare I answer it? Hello there. You're on the air.
Hi, Art. This is Andy in Melbourne, Australia. We spoke the other day.
Andy, how you doing?
I'm doing great, and the number works just fine.
Well, it's not exactly a number. It's just me.
Yes, that's true.
But it works. Anyway, you can hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
That's amazing. That's really cool. Now, I've got to figure out a way to get it back into the computer so that you'd be able to hear my guest if I had one of those on, and we're going to sort of work on that idea. But, I just wanted to test this. And so how the heck's Australia, Andy?
Australia's great. It's great. Summer's around the corner, so that's always nice.
What a lovely accent that is.
Thank you.
You're a tasty Australian, buddy.
I am.
Listen, thank you for the test. So that means we can probably get calls from anywhere. Plus, it's free. Right?
It is. It is certainly free.
All right, then. Andrew, thank you, my friend. Thanks for the test. Now we know we can do it.
No problem. Thank you very much.
See you later. I see I control Cheers. Those from here. So that's pretty slick. That really is pretty slick. So, I mean, if you've got Skype on your computer, now I would prefer you use a headphone, you know, and a mic, So it sounds like you have good audio. But now we've got something to play with. I love playing with technical stuff. I really do. So now you've got a way to get in from anywhere in the world. So that word will certainly get around. All right. We've got a good show coming up. Let's, for a second, talk about how to boost your Wi-Fi signal. Now, a lot of people are having trouble with the stream, and sometimes it's not the fault of SiriusXM and their stream. Sometimes it's your fault because you have a weak Wi-Fi signal. That's sort of one group of people that I'm talking to about this product. The other group is truckers. Oh, brother, if you're a trucker, you've got to have this super USB Wi-Fi antenna 3. It's kind of like the third generation of something that's already incredible. This is a Wi-Fi antenna that's, about maybe 11 or 12 inches long, something like that. It's got a suction cup on each end. It's got 15-foot wire, and then it's got a USB connector. So you order this from Sea Crane. If you're a trucker, use suction cup it to your window. Plug it USB into your whatever computer. And you will begin getting Wi-Fi signals. I'm just ballparking here. 7 or 8 times further than you would with just a computer sitting on the seat. I mean, big time better. Big time better. So, if you're a trucker, you need this. If you're at home and have a lousy Wi-Fi signal, you need this. It comes with a little software. You can put that in about a minute. Plug the USB in, and maybe you've got a computer that doesn't even have Wi-Fi. This will turn it into a computer that has Wi-Fi. I mean, it's just a cool way to go. Oh. Man, there's more people calling up. This is pretty interesting. The Sea Crane Company is 1-800-522-8863. 1-800-522-8863. Now, this antenna is just $99.95. 1-800, call right now because operators are standing by. 1-800-522-8863. And hello there. You're on the air, I think. No, I guess you're not. Here's another one. I'll try this one. Hello there. You're on the air. Going once. I can hear you. Are you there? Going twice. And gone. Well, I can always screen these calls, too. That's people just calling to mess with me. Well, that's not going to work. Because I'll just wait to a break and do it. All right, so Lloyd Auerbach is director of the Office of Paranormal Investigations. How's that for a title? And has been in the field for over 30 years, focusing on education and field investigation. He is the author of 8 books, rather prolific, I would say, a professor at Atlantic University. So he's a professor. And JFK University, and teaches parapsychology at HCH Institute in California. Wow. President of the Forever Family Foundation. He's also on the board of the Rhine Research Center and the advisory board of the Winbridge Institute. His media appearances on TV, radio, and in print number in the thousands, including ESPN SportsCenter, ABC's The View. He was on The View. Oprah and Larry King Live. He is a professional mentalist, psychic entertainer, a public speaking coach, and a professional chocolatier. Now, that's the one my wife would be interested in. Now, I'm getting all these Skype calls. Just before we go to break, I'm going to try one more. You better be out of the country if you're calling me. Hello there. You're on the air. Going once.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Where are you calling from?
India, my good Art Bell friend.
India, huh?
Yes, sir.
I don't think so.
I was wondering what your plans for the future of the show were.
What time is it in India right now?
Right now?
Yes.
It is 12 p.m., or should I say a.m.?
12 a.m., that's pretty cool, because it's 7:16 here.
Oh, wow. It's very early there.
It's also very wrong, my friend.
Yes.
Absolutely wrong. It would have to be 12:16. Gone like the wind, my friend. Not even a very good accent, frankly, as they go. So coming up in a moment is Lloyd Auerbach. He should be an extremely interesting guest, and you, with your accent, ought to be ashamed of yourself. I'm Art Bell. This is Dark Matter. Ho, ho, ho. Good stuff. All right, welcome back. Here we go. Lloyd Auerbach is my guest, and here he is. Lloyd, welcome to the program, and it's good to meet you.
Thanks very much, Art.
Good to have you. What part of the country are you in, Lloyd?
Outside of San Francisco.
San Fran, all right. Well, I believe, have you and I ever spoken? I don't think we've spoken, have we?
I think once a long, long, long time ago. Very long time ago. Maybe at the very beginning.
The very beginning?
Of your radio.
Yes, well, that would be a very long time ago.
Yeah.
You're on the board of directors, the advisory boards of all kinds of organizations in and around the field of parapsychology.
Yeah.
And you're a professor on top of everything else, right?
That's right.
And you actually teach this.
I teach parapsychology. I currently teach one online course for Atlantic University. And mm-hmm. for graduate and continuing mm-hmm. ed. And then I teach non-academic parapsychology courses locally here in the Bay Area and also for distance learning.
My God, I've got a lot of questions for you.
Okay. I have a lot
I
of answers.
Do. I almost don't know where to start. Let me ask you this. Are you familiar with a consciousness experiment going on at Princeton, the eggs, you know, all the all
oh, sure.
that?
Yeah, Roger Nelson and that group. Yeah, absolutely.
That's right. Can you explain to people what that's all about?
Sure. For a long time, parapsychologists have done psychokinesis research, mind over matter research, with something called a random event generator or random number generator. And,
right.
In simplest terms, and there are different forms of these things, it's a device that basically coin flips ones and zeros. And it does
right.
it very, very quickly, thousands of times per second. And the idea would be that you have an output, something you can either visually see or a sound that you can hear, that you try to affect. So you try to affect the direction of the output, whether it's a light going around in circles in a certain direction or mm-hmm. something going across the screen in a certain direction. As opposed to letting it go random, which is usually going to stay in the center and kind of bounce back and forth up and down in a random pattern. And you try to affect it. So there's an intention to and a goal to try to affect things. But over time, in terms of doing that research, they found there was an unconscious situation too. We have a lot of unconscious PK that happens, mind over matter that happens, especially with machines, with devices. And so the eggs, which stands for electrogyogram, are random event generators that are set up around the world, and they respond to people's unconscious output, you might say, instead of anything intentional.
So in other words, these are actually computers
right.
Issuing random numbers mm-hmm. in various spots around the world.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay.
The data comes from 50 or more of them now these days. I'm not sure
mm-hmm.
what he's up to now. Okay,
wow.
So, you know, there's something in parapsychology which has been picked up by other fields finally called the experimenter effect, which says that the experimenters do have an impact on the outcome of an experiment, regardless of whether it's a psychology experiment. And this is not necessarily a psychic thing, by the way, but psychology, chemistry, no matter what. But in parapsychology, when you're testing people to affect these devices, who are consciously trying to affect it, the experimenter, of course, also wants the subject to do really well. So we don't really know sometimes whether it's the experimenter affecting the device or the subject affecting the device.
Right.
So there is an unconscious thing. There's an unconscious intent. And what the thought is they put these around the world, and then they started looking at world events, because we do know that these things also respond, it seems, to highly charged emotional events. So if you look at the time around, for example, the outcome of the World Soccer match or the Super Bowl, Those are highly charged emotional events. And you look to see whether or not those times are non-random, whether there's a, you know, a non-random pattern happening at those times. And you also look at other times when there are no big events to see if they're staying random.
And this has been going on for a long time now. In fact, well below before 9/11.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah, there was a big spike actually that started about 24 hours before Princess Diana's death. In fact.
So we're trying to figure out whether human consciousness has an effect on these generators. I, of course, have interviewed people involved in this project, and it has fascinated me. What is your view, Professor? Do you think that in fact there's something to this? Have we done enough to know to say, hey, there's something to it?
I think, especially building on all the research that's been done before, there is definitely something to it. There's been enough PK research, and there are a few people in my field who look at the results of the random event generators a little differently. So they wouldn't necessarily agree, but a lot of us do believe that the outcomes of these being non-random in connection to or correlated to these events have occurred again and again and again and in a predictive fashion. So there is data that shows something is going on here.
That is so exciting and so interesting that I can barely keep it contained within me I got into this when I was doing the other show long ago, and then I started to run some experiments, Lloyd. I don't know if you kept up with that or not, but I had people concentrate, millions of people, on attempting to bring rain to areas where there had not been rain in a long time, you know, where they had drought and that sort of thing. And oh my God, it worked. It started raining within 30 minutes. Now, I did, I don't know, about 8 or 10 of these experiments, and I stopped. And the reason I stopped is because it actually started to scare me a little bit, in the sense that I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I'm just up here playing around on a radio program, maybe with something that I shouldn't be playing with.
Yeah, you know, maybe if we got everybody in the country so fed up with Congress could focus on that.
Don't tempt me. I haven't been doing recent experiments, but, you know, that one's really tempting. And besides, I'd go too far. You know, I'd harm them or something.
Well, you know, I think there certainly is a folklore of affecting the weather, and there have been people who have ostensibly been able to do that. And the idea of going too far, I think it really just depends. Getting a million people or millions of people together to do anything is an amazing achievement anyway, whether it's physically or just simply thinking about doing something.
True.
That's kind of an amazing thing. And, you know, most people with ESP experiments tend to get a little bored after a while in PK experiments. So I think you'd probably end up with the same thing unless you kept on upping the ante in some way.
Plus, we don't even really know, or do we, Professor, whether one person concentrating on something really hard has an equal effect, with say, a million, right?
Yeah. You know, that's a really interesting point, because, first of all, let's say that you just got everybody to think about creating rain. If there are groups of people in there who know something about the weather, they may actually be trying to do very specific things that could be at odds with what the unconscious of many of the others are doing. So you could have a tug of war where only one person actually is necessary to cause the rain at that point.
Right. Do you think that there's any possible danger in messing around with something like that? I mean, I actually told people, in your mind, picture the clouds over Texas, or I forget where it was, up in Washington or Canada, Western Canada. Picture clouds forming, moisture and clouds forming, and then eventually rain. And we did this for several minutes at a time during a break. And, you know, we had several instances, honest to goodness, Professor, of a day going by, and it was raining in these areas that I hadn't seen rain in months and months and months. That kind of deal. It worked to the point it kind of freaked me out.
Well, you know, the danger would be, there's two types of danger here. One is not putting an end date on the rain.
Yes, I know.
So you have to be really careful. It's kind of be careful what you wish for. So you really have to be pretty specific in your intention, too, for that. And the other danger is that, you know, a lot of people may start feeling like, oh, I did this, and they may take a little bit too much of a, you know, a power struggle in, within themselves. They may be a little delusional about what they think they did. And we have people, one of the things that we get asked all the time in the field is how come we don't test people to see if they're psychic and, you know, to certify them as psychic. And we do sort of, the Winbridge Institute has certified research mediums through a lengthy process. The Forever Family Foundation has a process too, but generally the field does not do open testing of people that walk into a laboratory and see if they have ESP, because I can tell you from personal experience, it only takes one person to come in and take part in an experiment, be told that they did really well, and the next thing they do is they hang up a shingle as a psychic.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you what finally stopped me was the following. There was a hurricane down in the Atlantic churning around, I suppose headed toward the U.S. pretty much, and people started emailing me, oh, come on, Art, let's turn it around. And I thought that was actually when I stopped, because what I thought was, you know, what if we turn it around and instead of being a Category 1 when it hits, it turns around, goes out to sea again, builds up into a Category 5, and then hits land. And that's when I said,
yeah,
you know what?
Yeah.
This might be dangerous. I quit.
This is where you have to be pretty specific, and I can only say you need to read a lot of comic books, because at that point, you'd want to start spinning the hurricane in the other direction like the Flash would in order to dissipate the power of the wind. And that would, instead of turning it around, you'd want to get rid of it.
Are you a tenured professor?
No, I'm not. I'm technically at JFK, I'm an adjunct professor, which doesn't have any tenured professors.
Okay.
And Atlantic is a small university. I'm just a faculty member there.
Okay. How are your classes? I mean, parapsychology is certainly a really interesting class. How well attended are your classes?
It goes up and down. You know, part of the university process, Atlantic University is a small university. Actually, it's a university that was originally started back in one form. It changed over the years by Edgar Cayce. So it's connected to the Association for Research and Enlightenment. And they do transpersonal psychology for the most part, and they have a parapsychology course, which I'm teaching there. So it's popular for the students who take it, but it's not a very large university to begin with, so the student population is not that large, and it's an elective. So when you have an elective, you hope that a lot of people will take it. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. When I'm teaching my non-academic courses, they kind of go in cycles. Right now, I just had a class with 15 people, which is a fairly large class for me, and I expect that my next couple of classes will be fairly large as well. But when people are taking these courses, there's no graduate degree in parapsychology these days anywhere in the United States. So it's kind of hard to get, you know, people to buy in to anything more than being interested. And
but if you want a fun credit.
Oh, sure.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I like to think that class would be fun. The fact is that if universities offered this subject at like a major university, you could guarantee that subject, that class would absolutely fill up no matter how large it is, especially
right.
as an elective. And that's a problem. I actually went through this years ago at a community college where I was offering a non-academic adult ed class, and they were afraid, some people in the social science department were afraid the student population would start asking for my class for credit. And as soon as they added my class, they'd have to delete one of their classes.
All right. Well, let me ask this. In your opinion, should there be a class at many major universities
Absolutely.
Taught by somebody like yourself?
There should be a class in parapsychology, if for nothing else than to ask the questions of why people are having these experiences.
Uh-huh.
Instead, you have an academic prejudice at almost every university against the subject. And it's very sad, because millions of people have these experiences, and mainstream science prefers to either ridicule or just simply say, oh, there's no data, and then ignore the things that are put right in front of their face.
Hear, hear. You're also president of the Forever Family Foundation, and I'd like to hear about that. It's got an upcoming afterlife conference in November, mm-hmm. and I want to talk to you about that, too.
Okay. Well, the foundation was started by a couple who had lost their daughter in an accident, and they... it was very traumatic for them, but through circumstances with friends, a medium had apparently communicated with their daughter enough to convince Bob Ginsberg, who is the CEO, who was a skeptic, But he was convinced by the quality of information that came through and the kind of information that came through the medium and the medium herself. And they felt incredible relief from grief by working with the medium. And they started the foundation originally to help connect people up with mediums who needed help, who had lost a family member, often who had lost their kids, to kind of help with the grieving process. And from there, they decided also to go into the sciences in terms of supporting research and spreading the word about the actual research that happens in looking at life after death and mediumship and reincarnation and such. So they've been real proponents for scientific investigation and research on the subject of everything from near-death experiences to mediumship.
I can imagine that somebody would be extremely relieved to hear from a loved one on the other side.
Yeah.
Here's my problem. I, too, am a severe skeptic.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I really am, but I want to believe. I really want to believe, and I would love to be convinced. Now, obviously, these folks became convinced. How strong was the evidence? Without, and you don't have to be specific if you don't want to be, but I am curious, what convinced them?
Well, I think it's the same thing that convinced me when I met a couple of mediums that they were genuine. And I've dealt with a lot of phonies over the years. I went into magic and mentalism as a part of my graduate studies specifically because I wanted to know the other side of the perceptual thing. I want to know how people misunderstand stuff, but I want to know about, be able to find the phonies too. So what's convincing is not just names, dates, and places. And that does come through, by the way. Unlike sometimes what you see on TV, some of these mediums are extremely specific. And it's not just names, dates, and places. It's statements that you've heard that person say. And it's statements that you've heard that person say to you, not in front of other people, and often...
Right.
You know, in a certain way. So there's like an emotional delivery. There's a delivery component here, too. It sounds like that person. The person is gesturing like the person who you lost. So there's a lot of elements here that are beyond just the facts. And the facts might be findable, but the other stuff is not findable.
Okay, well, let me just lay this out. If I wanted to communicate with Ramona, who's passed years ago in 2006, I would know... I guarantee you, Professor, I would know some questions to ask that would verify without question that I was talking to Ramona. Those kinds of questions were answered in that case?
In the case of the Ginsburgs, I'm not sure if they actually asked those kinds of questions. I think they got, most people don't ask those kinds of specific questions.
Oh, I sure would. How else do you get verification?
Verification comes without actually asking questions. You don't even have to ask the questions. That's the thing is that you probably would find that your questions would be answered before you got a chance to ask them.
That'd be just as good.
Yeah, and that's typically what happened with the Ginsburgs. That's what happened. That's what happens when I've talked to a few of the mediums that I've worked with over the years too. I've worked with people who are very suspicious. I'm very suspicious of, and some of them have turned out to be really good, and some of them have turned out to be, self-deluded. They thought they were so
yes.
That happens too. And the research process that is used by Winbridge, for example, and it's kind of an outgrowth of the work of Gary Schwartz. It's now Dr. Julie Beischel who does it. It removes even the feedback element. There's no feedback that the medium gets from the sitter whatsoever. In fact, the medium only gets the first name of the person they're supposed to contact. And the sitter is supposed, who doesn't even hear what the response is at that point, is supposed to mentally try to tell their Uncle Harry, please go talk to the medium, because we're doing this right now. So there's a kind of a separation, and it's more than a double-blind experiment. It's something like a quintuple-blind experiment at this point.
I mean, we're talking about two things here. One, being able to connect to a loved one on the other side.
Right.
And two, verifying there is another side.
There is an element that one aspect that is very difficult for us to parse out, and that is that if it's something, for example, if something you knew, if you asked about Ramona and
yes.
asked the question to the medium, and the medium gave you the answers, and you were immediately, that's correct. The fact that you knew the answers and you're sitting right there is a problem, because what if the medium is actually just picking it up from you? The medium might be fairly sincere and may actually believe.
Well, if that's the case, then you're proving that minds can be read.
Of course, that's correct. It's a little bit of a conundrum for us because is it ESP with the living or is it ESP with the dead? And we have to kind of go beyond. We have to look at what kind of information a psychic can get from a living person generally and compare that to what the mediums are getting from ostensibly the people on the other side from the deceased. And there is a difference.
Let me suggest that either way, it's incredibly exciting because if you're proving ESP, then it's not much of a jump, in my mind anyway, to believe there can be another side, to believe that we have souls, that we have abilities that we don't even begin to understand. The whole schmear. It's exciting either way.
That is correct. And what's unfortunate is we can't get mainstream science to even look at the data or acknowledge that there are research studies at all.
Well, then they're as idiotic as Congress.
Yeah, that's about the size of it.
All right. So you've kind of been on all sides of this. In other words, you've been connected to paranormal television shows,
mm-hmm.
I guess, in some way, hopefully as an
advisor. Not the more recent ones, with only a couple of exceptions. I really am not involved with most of the ghost hunting shows because...
Oh, you didn't do The Walking Dead?
Oh, I'd love to do The Walking Dead. I've read the comic book. Are you kidding?
Yeah, it's great stuff.
I'd love to be a guest star, guest zombie on The Walking Dead. <That'd be fun.
laughs> But you have been involved with TV shows and so forth.
So, ever since the very beginning of my career, and even before.
I would think on what, a consultation basis? Or?
I've consulted with a bunch of shows. I very often get interviewed for news shows and some of the other, I just did a Japanese public broadcasting show on ghosts a couple weeks ago. So we did a segment at a location, a haunted location here. So, I'll often go to the locations and kind of talk about the places and even do a little investigation sometimes for the show. But I have consulted with shows behind the scene, and not just, there have been a few non-reality shows that I've consulted with. I consulted on an episode of L.A. Law many, many years ago.
Oh, no kidding.
And a couple of movie writers, film writers have talked to me about things. And my first book has actually been named by Whoopi Goldberg and a few other people as having helped the screenwriter of the movie Ghost, in fact.
Okay. Would you say, and I certainly would, that the Japanese, and they're mainly Buddhist, right? I know
Buddhist
the
Shinto,
the Filipinos, mainly Catholic, and even if you go to say Thailand, on and on and on through Asia, they are incredibly interested in paranormal and ghost type things, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. The Western culture, Western materialist science, empiricism kind of takes sway here, but in most parts of the world, you find a real interest in the subject. And people in some parts of the world accept this not as paranormal, but as very normal. Psychic experiences are a normal part of their daily life.
Fascinating. All right, Professor, hold it right there. We're going to take a break. You can relax for about 5, and we'll be right back. This is Dark Matter. I'm Art Bell with Lloyd Auerbach. That is so good. Welcome back, everybody. Professor Lloyd Auerbach is my guest, and a really, really interesting one at that. Professor, welcome back.
Thank you.
I want to give you a couple examples. Of course, I've had a lot of, psychics over the years. And generally, I've found them to be very disappointing, particularly the ones that come on the radio and say, call now, and I'll give you my reading. However, there have been a couple of people in and out of my life that have impressed me mightily. One of them is Danyon Brinkley.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to not only speak to people on the other side, but talk about and actually see things at a distance that proved to be accurate in the real world now, things that he had no way to see at all, positively. I checked it out, and yet he saw them, could call the kind of car, the color of the car, where it was, that kind of thing. Very, very impressive. And the other, believe it or not, a witch named Evelyn Paglini. who probably made more right calls than anybody I've ever had on the program. So those two impressed me. Most of the rest of them,
Yeah, you know, it's hit or miss with certain people. There are a lot of people out there who are psychics who are out there, you know, talk a good talk, and they may be good in certain circumstances and not in others. It just really, I've met so many people who are good at what they do in certain areas, but they tell everyone, because that's what they think they have to do, that they're 95% accurate or 100% accurate. And, you know, years ago, I put together a paper for a conference on psychics and mediums, looking at the qualities of the best psychics, besides just whether they're accurate. And one of the qualities of better psychics is not overstating their abilities, because they're well aware what they can do and what they can't do. In other words, they're like normal people in that way. They're very well grounded, and they don't play as divas. You know, they don't try to step all over every other psychic that's there. They play well with others. They have a good sense of humor, and they don't even take themselves seriously, which I think sense of humor is one of the key factors for what's a good psychic.
All right. If you had to make a giant generalization and say, look, I've seen psychics because of what I do, and you have, and many, many of them, what percentage do you think are real, and what percentage do you think are
It's hard to... I can tell you the people who have come to my attention, I'd say probably there's like 20% at the top. It's like the 80-20 rule. There's 20% at the top who have real ability. There's another 80% that have mixed abilities or no ability, and in that 80% are people who think that they're psychic because maybe they're pretty observant and somebody in their family convinced them that they were psychic.
Right.
There's a lot of people who are sincere but are that way. And then I've met people who are absolute phonies, so I can't even put numbers to the ones that that are out there. I usually just tell people to be real careful when they're seeing a psychic to make sure that they know what they're getting, and part of that is to listen to what's happening and decide if it's useful, because if it's a really good psychic and they don't give you any useful information, they could say all sorts of things to convince you that they're genuinely psychic, and you pay your money, but that didn't do anything for you with entertainment.
I would imagine in your position, by the time most psychics get to you, they've been sort of vetted in some way or another. Yes?
Well, or they like to think that they're vetted, a lot of them.
I see. When they get to you, they're very vetted. How about that?
Some of them are, yeah. Certainly, I've met a number of the mediums through the Forever Family Foundation who have gone through a certification process, kind of a study process that they have there. And I met a few of the ones who have gone through Winbridge Institute's very intensive research medium certification. And they have them up on both websites, has a list of those folks. In fact, one of my friends, somebody who came to me as a student, and then at the end of the class, after seeing that I was okay, she decided to tell me that she was psychic, and I started working with her to see how she was, and she was very good. And I recommended that she go through the certification program. She did a great job. I mean, she passed. She's one of their 20 research mediums. So,
okay. Can I please ask, if somebody like that comes to you and they want to be vetted, they want the certification process, whatever it is, how's it done?
Well, for
whatever you can tell me, I'm sure some of
sure.
it you probably don't want to talk about, but whatever.
The Forever Family Foundation does basically Skype readings. Part of it is it's not perfect. It's not as good as the very extensive and unfortunately expensive process that Winbridge does, but the mediums will come to Forever Family. They'll fill out an application. There's a bit of a background check that's there as well. And then they have to do readings for, I think it's 5 people right now, and they do them by Skype. And then those readings are scored by both the sitters and judges to see how well they did. And one of the things that's being judged is whether they're making generalizations, whether they're, you know, you look at each of the statements, not just the overall reading, but you do consider the overall reading as well. You know, coming at this also with a background in psychic entertainment, it's not hard for people to convince other people that they're psychic. It's not hard to do a reading and convince somebody that you know all about them, especially if you talk about the sitter's personality.
Right. Here's a question for you. The ability that some talented entertainment psychics have to figure out what they should be saying. What is that process? As they're talking with you, they'll ask little questions and probe a little bit. Mm-hmm. And if they get one answer, it means they go in one direction. They get another, they go in another direction, right?
Well,
what is that?
That's generally called cold reading.
Cold reading.
Cold reading, yeah. And if you look up cold reading on the internet, you'll find stuff. Actually, you'll find two kinds of cold reading. One will be relating to psychic stuff, and the other will be actors cold reading their scripts when they go in for auditions. But,
okay.
Yeah, cold reading is a technique. You basically, it's just reading a person's cold. And, you know, salespeople do that. A lot of people, reporters do that. It's a process of observation. And technically, Sherlock Holmes would have made a hell of a psychic if he actually could do what Arthur Conan Doyle said he could do. So it's really, it's not just the fishing piece of things. It's also a lot of observation. It's looking at how people react to statements. And frankly, the best psychics do that unconsciously without even thinking about it. You know, everybody does that to some extent. So if you are a psychic and you are about to say something, the person is, you know, the thing that you just said either made the person upset or was perhaps down the wrong track, you're not going to ignore that.
Okay, Professor, you're talking about intuition, really. You know, if a very intuitive person is at work with you, they're going to be able to,
yeah.
If you're pretty psychic, but there's a line between intuition and holy crap, it's real.
And that's named dates and places. That's the fact stuff that they have to do research on you to find. And you have to make sure that they didn't do that or know that they didn't do it. You know, right now, given how much stuff people put on Facebook, if you're giving your name and credit card number to the psychic before you go see them, you're taking a shot that, you know, it's 50-50. Are they going to look you up or are they not going to look you up? So it's really hard to know from that.
Yeah, they're going to look you up. So it must be more and more than difficult for somebody like yourself in this social media world to call out the chaff.
It can be. I certainly don't work it off of readings for me, you know, reading me, but I will take them to locations where I know certain things about the location. I'll take them to haunted locations if that's what they want to do. Usually the psychics come to me these days want to try being an investigative medium or go out investigative psychic. They want to go to a haunted location and see if they can do anything there. So I'll take them to places where I know things that they don't know and they couldn't find out. At least not very easily, and see how they do, and see how they do just in general with the situation, with the investigation.
Well, let me ask you a little about haunted locations. Is there any question in your mind when we start discussing this, and I say, Professor, there really are haunted locations where whatever it is, something non-human is present?
Well, if by non-human you mean a deceased person, that is
yes.
Yes.
I do indeed mean that, yes.
And we make a distinction in parapsychology between in locations that have seemingly recorded past events, which people, living people, are capable of replaying in their heads, and the actual discarnate or deceased person who's sticking around and either trying to communicate or just simply hanging out. So we call, when we're talking about apparitions or cases with an apparition, that would be an interactive person who has died, usually a deceased person, versus the place memory, the location itself has memory. So, for example, the Gettysburg battlefield, people have reported, and I've talked to people back in the 80s, I talked to a lot of people who were extras on Ted Turner's Gettysburg miniseries shoot.
Right.
And they were experiencing pretty much the same thing. I talked to several different people. And they're experiencing seeing a battle, and they all described the same battle, and it was interesting because they all figured out very quickly that they were not seeing ghosts. They were not seeing people replaying or, you know, actual people. They were seeing an image from the past, which is typically what we would consider a haunting, versus the apparition where if the soldiers all stopped shooting at each other and said to the reenactors, who are you? That would be that would be something different.
Okay, so you're going to make me jump from thing to thing. Now, let's talk about locations. So interesting, because some people believe that hauntings, as it were, are not a really contemporary thing on the other side, that hauntings are some sort of vibrational memory attached to a place.
Right.
Where can you go with that?
Well, I mean, whether it's vibrational or that's where we think the electromagnetic field comes in, the geomagnetic field of the Earth, that seems to be the case because we also have hauntings of living people, recordings of living people. I've had many cases where what's reported as the phenomena turns out to be images or sounds or even voices of people who are still alive.
Because wow.
It's living people who make those impressions, not deceased people.
And those impressions linger in a place?
Yeah, it's likely, I mean, the best we can figure out, it's environmental. And this could be purely a biophysical thing in the sense that it's imprinted in the environment and our brains pick it up for some people who are sensitive enough to it. We have some models that we like to think about and we'd love to test out if there was actually any funding for it. But given the lack of funding for parapsychological work, we can't even test out the model these days.
All right. So if somebody who's a real psychic goes to one of these places where there's an imprint, it's going to hit them pretty hard.
It very well could hit them pretty hard if, in fact, they're the kind of psychic who picks up on that kind of information. I know of one psychic who works really well with the police, but when she goes into haunted locations, she's practically deaf, dumb, and blind.
Really?
Yeah. So the media has kind of given us this idea, and certain psychics have done the same thing too, that a psychic is a catch-all for everything. But it's kind of like, you know, a painter doesn't necessarily sculpt, and even if he tried, probably couldn't, unless he was somebody who could cross over to that. So you really have to consider that people, just like athletes, have particular talents. Whether it's creatively or otherwise, there are different psychic applications and abilities. Some people are extremely good at remote viewing, but if they were in a room full of 10 ghosts, they couldn't see a single one of them.
All right, let's talk for a second about remote viewers, because Lord knows I've had enough of them on my program, and there really was, of course, a CIA program for remote viewers. Or
actually,
are you saying no? No?
Yes and no.
Yes and
my,
no. Okay.
My colleague, Ed May, was the program director of that program for the last 10 years. And, of course, I know Russell Targ and Hal Putoff, who started the program.
Right.
And I'm the third author on a book about, which is sitting with publishers right now. We're still waiting for the publishers to say whether they like it or not, about the inside scoop, politically and otherwise, on the Stargate program, as well as the Russian programs. We actually have contributions from several Russian generals about what was going on in the Soviet Union and Russia for the last 20 years.
What do you know about
actually
Russia?
Actually, not as much as people think it is. It's pretty interesting that when I was reading their accounts, the accounts of these, one of whom was the guy was the second in command of the KGB when the Soviet Union fell. They did a lot of psychic research. And in fact, in the Chechnya War, there were trained psychics, like remote viewers, in some of the tanks on the front line.
Wow.
So they had people, and they've used psychics for law enforcement, too, within the government and such. When you mention the CIA program, the CIA had the program for a very short period of time. It was a Defense Department program. It got shuffled over to the CIA. The CIA then did an assessment of whether they wanted to do anything with the program, and they decided no. So they shut the program down. But however, one of the things that Ed found out was that the CIA had asked for all the files and was going to do an assessment, but the CIA did only an assessment from the time that they took over the program going forward, which had very few actual remote viewing missions. They never even opened the boxes, according to someone in the CIA. They never actually even looked at the old files. So it was kind of a boondoggle to even give, because they didn't want it. It was just a political hot potato at that point.
Okay, let's go back for a second to the Russians having remote viewers in tanks. Now, that's really, you would not have expected, or I wouldn't have expected, they went to that extent.
Well, if you have
so was somebody in there saying, look, instead of where we're going, turn 270 degrees, you know, we've got an enemy over there. How did that work? Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's some of it. Also, how to avoid any issues of being attacked. A lot of it was about defense as much as offense.
Sure.
And you know, that's a real application, like a on-point application. They felt that putting them in the tanks, I guess it was motivational, you might say. Instead of having them back at some other location to view what was going on, this way they could actually be there a little closer to the action. And so they were all got trained in the Army, too. So it wasn't a situation where they just took psychics and stuck them in tanks. They had to be trained as Army personnel, too.
God, that's fascinating. Do you know for what period of time that went on?
That was during the Chechnya War. I'm not sure.
All the way through?
Yeah, as far as I know, it was all the way through. I'd have to look up the material from that particular general, as to how far through it
was. Oh, that's a real wow. I have never heard this anywhere before.
I have to tell you that, you know, when I read the book, the manuscript, I ended up being kind of the rewriter just to make it all cohesive. And I was blown away by some of the stuff that came from the Russians in the sense that another interesting thing, you know, we've all heard about psychotronic generators, and the Russians were working on those in the 70s, and these were generators.
No, not everybody's heard about them. What are they?
Well, there was a book called Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain that came out back in the 70s. Very, very famous book.
Right.
And a lot of stuff came out of Russia that indicated the Russians were working on psychic weaponry. And this was like the story that was going around. And it was in the press. I mean, it was in the media all over the place, in fact. And it was in books, and people were talking about the Russians, the psychic arms race, and the Russians were way ahead of us. And one of the things that they were supposedly working on were psychotronic weapons, psychotronic meaning electronic, psychological, or mind, you know, basically psychic weaponry. And the idea to create a psychotronic generator, a generator that could generate energy from your mind, okay?
Okay.
And there was research that was done, according to the Russian generals who submitted this stuff. And there was a scientist involved in the project, too. But the interesting thing that came up as I'm reading this, the scientist who's involved said, yes, we tested a lot of this the stuff out, and none of it worked. People were still being encouraged by the government to try to invent psychotronic generators. And they would drop by the lab, and they'd come to the reception desk and say, I have a psychotronic generator. It works. You should test it and make use of it. I'm being a good, you know, good Soviet citizen. And they take the box, and they say, thank you very much. And as soon as the person left, they toss it into a storeroom because none of them work.
If you don't mind, let's define this. When you say psychotronic generator, is that right?
Yeah. The idea is to create an energy source that the mind would fuel.
All right, so basically, are we talking about an amplifier?
Not necessarily an amplifier for psychic ability, but a power source that could be adapted to weaponry or other things that the mind, you know, somebody's psychic ability would fuel.
All right, define psychic weaponry. I'm trying to understand. I mean, I understand a guy sitting in a tank saying, go that away. But psychic weaponry...
Well, you mentioned the word amplifier. Amplifier is one of the things they're trying to
do. That's right.
The other is that they were trying to make weapons of psychics. So the idea is that... and there have been experiments where people have tried to stop the heart of a frog. Or, you know, we've seen science fiction movies where people have tried to kill someone psychically.
Right.
Stop their heart or do things. So that's what we were hearing was coming out of Russia.
Okay.
And
was there any record at all of success? In other words, nobody killed a frog?
Well, these guys didn't talk about that. I did hear from another researcher that supposedly they did stop the heart of a frog, but it was only once. And it's like, you know, we hear that we have this the men who stare at goats thing that came out.
Right.
I know the martial artist who taught those guys. I worked with him years and years ago.
Really?
And it wasn't the men who stare at goats. You might turn it around and say it was the men who touched the goats. Because he taught them, he was supposed to be teaching them something called the dim mak, which is a delayed death touch. It's a legendary thing in kung fu. And
delayed death touch.
So you basically slap or touch someone, and short time after, there is a disruption of the organ closest to where you touch them, and they die.
Wow.
Now, does that really happen? Well, according to Guy Civelli, who is the person, and other martial artists, it's real. I mean, there are people who have said that it's real. And Guy had years ago sent me photographs of what happened. He had to show these army guys that he could do this. And So he sent me pictures of a gut, unfortunately, of an opened up goat that had messed up internal structure, because he apparently did that. I've also seen video footage of some army guys he taught, special forces guys he taught, who basically slap a watermelon, they crack it open, and it's completely mush inside, which is the same concept, yeah.
So if you get a slap in the head, you'd be mush.
Theoretically, yeah.
Now, if I ask you if there's anything to any of that, your response would be what?
Generally, people have a psychic shield up that they're not even aware of. So most people would not be susceptible to that.
Okay. You wouldn't expect a frog to have such a shield.
Probably not. Yeah, not so much a frog or a goat. Yeah.
Oh, Lord, this is really, really, really fascinating. All right, Professor, stay right where you are. Another break this hour. This really is fascinating. A psychic slap. Dark matter. In the nighttime, from the high desert, I'm Art Bell. Guest is Professor Lloyd Auerbach. And boy, is this fascinating stuff. Psychic weaponry. None of this was on the list to talk about, so I apologize for, you know, leading you off into other areas, but it's just too interesting not to do. Psychic weaponry. So it leads to another question. Let's assume we have somebody who's somewhat talented in causing a frog heart to stop, or something lesser even, but is, you know, definitely the real McCoy. Professor, is it possible to more deeply train in a discipline like heart stopping with frogs or something like that? In other words, can you train and become more and more and more effective, kind of like Carrie did?
You know, it doesn't seem to be that way, no. The PK thing, it's psychokinesis, it's mind over matter. There's a lot of stumbling blocks for people to get past. And they're all so deeply ingrained in us that the carry thing is what we would call a poltergeist case. It's an unconscious reaction that, because the unconscious doesn't have the same kind of filters that and biases and blocks that the conscious mind actually does. So PK doesn't seem to work that way. And on top of that, it doesn't really seem to work very well when you try to attack someone, unless they, you know, here's the thing. Psychic healing works. People can do psychic healing. But there's one thing that makes psychic healing not work, and that is if the patient doesn't want to get better. So it doesn't matter how good the healer is. If that person doesn't want to get better, they're not going to get better.
All right, you led me into yet another area, psychic healing.
That's the flip side of the weaponry, of attacking.
It is. But let me ask about this. There have been all these studies, Professor, about, and blind studies at that, I believe, or double blind even, where people didn't know that large groups were praying for them
right.
to get better. Now, prayer is, I don't know how you,
it's a form
how
of
you it, differentiate.
It's a form of intention.
There you are.
Yeah.
They're directed intention, yes. And these studies seem to prove that these people get better versus the ones that are not prayed for. How sure, how righteous are those experiments?
The experiments are very well done. I mean, Larry Dossey and other folks who have done them are well done experiments. The question then is, you have to have subjects who are willing or wanting to get better under any circumstance.
Sure.
And it's an issue where, you know, it couldn't hurt. It's one of those things, you know, it's like chicken soup. It couldn't hurt.
But it's got to get past it couldn't hurt. It's got to get past.
Oh, sure,
there
sure. Yeah,
to,
I mean,
yes, it really is proven to work. Do you believe that?
I do. There are studies also of mice and, you know, using animals in situations where they've actually, you know, cut a piece of skin off the mouse, very small piece, and then watched how long it takes for the mouse to heal.
Right.
And then you have a healer do it, and versus a control subject where, you know, where the mouse is, a mouse has not had a healer on him, and there is a speeding up process with the healer. So there's something going on with that going on, and it's also been done with plants and other things. So there's definitely a positive effect that someone can actually have when there is, especially when there's an injury or some sort of illness, where the organism's goal is to feel good, is to feel better.
So people who talk to their plants aren't crazy.
Well, you know, whether the plants can understand you is a whole different question, I think.
No.
But the intention is good.
I love
you,
plant. Yeah. Be healthy. Get green, whatever. You know, intention.
Yeah, it's intention. That's right. That's absolutely right.
And you think it works to some degree.
There seems to be an effect.
All right.
They probably didn't need to talk to the plant. They could just probably think about it.
I'm going to take you back to an easier one, and we'll come back to this. You recently wrote a sort of indictment of paranormal reality TV on your website, calling it On Reality TV, listing a bunch of points of disagreement and problems. What? Go ahead. Let them have it.
Okay, I've been around television a really long time. In fact, my family's in television. My father was a producer for NBC, and after that went on his own, and he produced, among other things, the Tournament of Roses Parade and the Rose Bowl for international broadcast. My uncle Larry was a soap opera director and active with the Directors Guild. One of my brothers works for the Today Show as a stage manager. I've been around television since before I was born, basically. I kind of grew up at NBC at 30 Rock. So, you know, I know behind the scenes, and I know how this all works, and I've been involved in enough TV programs myself, and even approached by production people who have pitched shows to me that I've usually said no to. I've said yes to a bunch that never got on the air because, unfortunately, they weren't playing the game. Uh-huh. And the game is that, you know, they're about ratings, and that's okay. I mean, these shows are ostensibly supposed to be entertainment, but they have taken a life of their own in terms of the fans believing or buying into them being the way things are and should be. And that they've created both an ever-increasing interest in the paranormal, which is the positive side.
Oh, yes.
But they have also taken away from people in my field a lot of, not credibility, but, you know, the attention and interest. You can't get most of the ghost hunters interested in parapsychology. They're not interested in that. They only are going to follow what they see on TV. And that in itself is crazy. It's like watching Cops and suddenly deciding you're going to be a cop, a vigilante running around.
Well, actually, the truth is, a lot of times when I watch Cops, I think, man, that would have been a good career, you know?
Yeah. Well, and if you go through the police academy, that's cool.
Yeah.
Or even get a private investigator's license, that's okay. But you're not going to run around knocking down people's doors and doing other things, you know.
That's right. Well, and the truth is, we're all about ratings. I'm about ratings.
Of course.
People listening.
And that there's no reason, you know, I have no problem with that whatsoever. What I have a problem with is the way that the production people are handling both the talent or the people on the shows and anyone who is a client on the shows or is an expert coming into the shows. In that, most people are unaware, or they seem to think that, for example, the guys in Ghost Hunters, Jason and Grant, and maybe today they have a lot more input on the show, but certainly the first few years they had no input on the show whatsoever. And they, you know, it's not like they sit in the edit booth and have anything to say about what goes on. And they're signed to a non-disclosure agreement, as are almost everyone on these shows, where they could never say, you know, that show, they changed the order of the way things happened. That show, that was faked. That show, those things never happened. They can't say that because they'll get in serious legal trouble if they do. So they've created, and I can tell you that I've been approached by several different shows who wanted to have me on as a guest or, you know, as somebody to be interviewed, and the release forms for many of these shows is 4 or 5 pages long and includes language about for the non-disclosure, but more than that, includes language that a recent one I saw for a colleague of mine said, we may intentionally defame you, and you can't, and, you know, you're okay with that.
Oh, my God. That's going pretty far.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's one thing for a standard release where, you know, somebody accidentally says something or does something or cuts it wrong and you come off looking like an idiot, which happens because the editors don't usually know what's going on. But and you can't sue. I mean, that's normal for any release that you sign. But to be told up front that you may be humiliated, defamed, and it may be maliciously. And so as long as you sign this, you can't sue us. And you can't even talk.
I would never, ever sign something like that.
Neither would I, but there are enough people who want to get on TV who do sign those things. And that's part of the problem.
I see. Have you ever had the opportunity to shepherd a TV show about the paranormal and really tell them the right way to do it?
I have, until it gets to the network. I've worked with multiple production companies. I'm working with one production company right now. We've got a great show concept, and we're kind of hoping to take it. We may take it out of the country because we can't get anybody in the country to buy into it because it's, you know, you talk to some, they look at it and they say, oh, it's too much like the other shows. It's actually not. They always claim that they want something new, and then when it comes right down to it and they're choosing between your show and someone else's show and your show is different, and the other show is just like their, like the ones that are on, they choose the one that's just, that's like one that's on because they know that it gets ratings typically, at least for a short time.
Why do you think there is this ever-present and really growing interest in the paranormal?
Well, I think we can look to religion in some respects.
Oh, yes.
All the surveys of religion, of traditional religions, they're losing hold on people. People, it's the same reason that spirituality and spiritual practices have kind of grown over the last 30 years. People are looking outside rigidity and the traditional modes of connecting with each other and connecting with the universe. So I think that this is just one other way in general. And that's for a lot of people who watch the show. So, of course, there's that hardcore segment that are thrill seekers, and they just want to follow along and, you know, be there with these guys and have their own TV show.
The number of people going to church in America has dropped drastically.
Yeah, I know. I know. And there was a recent survey of American Jews, of which I am one, that shows how few of us are actually even identifying ourselves that way anymore, other than culturally, which is true.
Huh. And so you think they're moving from traditional religion to examination of the paranormal generally?
It's just one other avenue. I think the people are looking at various avenues right now. Some people are looking in this direction. Other people
are looking... let me put it a different way. People are very spiritual. They're just turning from the traditional spiritual avenues of religion to others.
I think that's true. I think people are searching for other things, and this is one area, because we're really talking about the human spirit in many, many different dimensions. Not the paranormal shows so much, but just generally.
That's right. No, we are. So people are not less interested in the spiritual, the paranormal. They're just...
I don't even know if they're turning away from God so much as they're turning away from the image of God that they've been getting in their churches or synagogues.
That's right. That's right. I don't know. That's kind of sad in one way. Do you think there's anything that traditional religion can do to turn this around?
Well, I think
That's not in your pay grade, but
it's not. I think that they need to be more welcoming for people to question and discuss what their own experience is of the divine or not, and even discuss how one should try to have experiences, and they need to be open to looking outside the practices, the rigid practices and rituals that are hundreds if not thousands of years old.
Maybe they need a situation where it's call Father Jenkins and he'll do a reading on you now.
Possibly, yeah.
I shouldn't be laughing about that. But
psychic,
I mean,
priest might not be a bad idea.
Gee. Okay, so now I want to come back to and finish on psychic weaponry, because that's just so fascinating. Have you ever, Professor, seen anybody affect something material, anything, I don't care, take a pen, or in my case, a vaping cigarette, and hold it and put it right there and knock it over? You know, in other words, have you ever seen anything, even at the lower levels of, here's a feather, make it fly?
I absolutely have seen PK. I have actually trained people to do PK. I worked with a gent by the name of Martin Caden many years ago, who was a science fiction writer and science writer. He's the guy who created the $6 Million Man TV show. And Marty was, when I met him in 92, I was shocked to find out this guy whose books I've been reading all along was able to, or said, claimed to be able to move objects and then showed that he could do it. And I worked with him under very controlled conditions, and he was able to actually affect small targets. You know, not
like
big.
What? Like what?
Mainly, I mean, most of what he did was turning something that almost sounds absurd, but turning little paper targets or metal targets
no.
to balance
oh, no.
on spindles.
It's fine. No,
yeah.
I'll buy into that.
I'm sorry, I
stomped on you. You just had little paper targets or what?
Or metal targets or other
or
targets.
Metal.
They were balanced on spindles and
wow.
getting them to spin, but getting them to spin, you know, not out in the open, getting them to spin behind, you know, in an enclosed space.
I understand.
And I'm pretty much on demand. In other words, we'd sit and watch behind a glass wall, a window, in a closed space with a lot of targets. And he would tell me to tell him when to make the targets move. And I'd decide when to do that, and then the targets would start moving.
Professor, how do you actually watch something like that happening without a shiver going down your spine?
Well, it's not a shiver. For me, it's just a sense of cool. it's hard to explain, but way back when I was a little kid, I'm a TV baby because my father was in television, and I watched all sorts of shows from very young age, like Topper and One Step Beyond and Twilight Zone and things like that. And I got into comic books and science fiction, and to me, growing up and being a little science geek, because I was into astronomy and geology as a kid too, I looked at what was in the comic books, and then I saw this stuff on psychic people, and I thought, well, they're like real, like superheroes. And looking into that and finding out eventually when I was about 13 that there was actually a science, parapsychology, and starting to read the material, none of it made no sense to me. In other words, it made sense that people could do this for some reason. It didn't surprise me. So when I've been in situations where things have moved, either intentionally from someone like Martin Caden, or in a couple of the poltergeist cases where I've been in where things have been moving around, or even a couple of the ghost cases where things have moved without any motive force, apparent motive force. You know, it's a sense of excitement that I get, not a sense of
how about an academic paranormal shiver? In other words,
there is a wow factor. There's no question about that. There is that wow factor.
Well, if people can move little metal objects or cause things to begin to rotate, then it's not too much of a jump to stopping that frog's heart.
Except the frog probably doesn't want his heart stopped.
Probably not, but seriously, if you can do one can imagine the other might be done as well.
Possibly. But again, you know, what we do know about psychic attack, or the reverse, you know, psychic damage, you might say,
right.
is that the organism does have a survival instinct, and that, and we all have some, even probably every organism has some psychic self-defense mechanism, but certainly living people do, and higher animals do as well, that prevents them from allowing that to happen. It's kind of like, you know, if somebody curses you, the curse only has an effect if you believe in it.
Is that absolutely true?
You can psychologically work at somebody so that they start doubting. That'll work. They don't have to believe it fully, but they just have to have that doubt in their minds.
Voodoo, right?
Well, voodoo is voodoo for the most part is positive. It's not negative. But the voodoo bokor is the guys who do the negative stuff. There's as much poison as there is magic involved for a lot of that.
You know what witches say about it? If you direct bad intention, it mm-hmm. comes back on you many-fold.
That's kind of a karmic idea. And
that's
I know
right.
the Wiccans believe that, and in certain other cultures they believe that as well. What's unfortunate is we certainly don't see that in practical application with with some of the corporate people and the bankers and everybody else, do we?
Oh, if only.
Yeah.
So, having seen all this, it must have changed your life, your way of thinking. If I can get this personal with you.
Sure.
Are you you're not a strictly, you mentioned you're Jewish.
I grew up,
background,
yeah.
But you're not participating in organized religion on a regular basis, right?
No, and on, I mean, even though I'm very, it's very flip to say this, but I think the closest I could say is I'm a Jedi. Because that's I kind of, I don't believe in a guy up on high, and anything, you know, super intelligent that's pulling our strings. But I do believe there's something that connects us all. That there's definitely something that connects us.
The concept of a God?
You could call it God. I mean, some people do call it God. I don't call it God. I call it, you know, and I think the force is as good a word as any, and God is as good a word as any also. So, or gods. It's something, it's an interconnecting, you know, it's the grand unified field, if you want to call it, to talk about it from physics perspective.
The grand unified field.
Yeah, something connects us all. I mean, everything in the universe is connected. It's that sense of interconnectedness, which, you know, is kind of what entanglement's about. Quantum entanglement.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. It is. Do you have any thoughts? The whole concept of entanglement, I can't wrap my mind around it. For two particles that are separated by the world, or, you know, even up to the moon or out into space, doing the same thing at the same time, without some form of communication, just doesn't make sense to me, and yet it's the truth.
Right. It doesn't make sense to us yet. You know, it may make sense to us down the road when physics is able to figure out how information transfers, if in fact there is a transfer of information, rather than just simply something else going on. But I don't know what else could be going on. You know, there's distance as far as we know the way space works, but maybe this is something outside of space, outside of space-time that's happening.
Maybe, but once you embrace this, then it seems like all kinds of things become possible.
Sure. I mean, think about being able to create a communication device that doesn't rely on, that doesn't need to worry about distance at all.
Exactly. Actual speed of light.
Yeah.
Speed of light.
It's beyond the speed of light because...
Right.
It's instantaneous. It's happening at the same, almost at the same moment, or at the same moment. So,
Einstein could only work up a spooky something at a distance.
Spooky action at a distance.
Action at a distance. Yes.
Yeah, he wasn't very happy about it, apparently.
Right, and so relegated it to that. That doesn't mean it's not real. It is, in fact, we know now.
Right, that's very much real.
And so, doesn't it fit very, very nicely into the whole world of parapsychology?
It does. The big factor that we have to figure out in physics for it to be really present for parapsychology is how information goes from that quantum level to our macro consciousness level.
Right.
And it's the size difference that really is, or the size barrier that has to be broken. We have to figure out how that's all happening. But it's likely that some form of, if we are talking about ESP, which does seem to not rely on distance or worry about distance or time for that matter, then, yeah, entanglement's probably a good piece of that based on what we know about physics right now.
Again, you were talking about psychokinesis.
Mm-hmm.
Many ghost movies, certainly, and perhaps in real life, ghost occurrences seem to be coupled with psychokinesis, in other words, books falling
right,
off of shelves
right,
and
right.
movement of various sorts, of electric lights blinking on and off. So you think they are attached? Have you ever seen these things occurring?
I have, but I will say it's pretty rare to actually have a... It seems like when people die and stick around as ghosts, they have a learning curve. It's not like you're suddenly... First of all, you're not smarter because you're dead. That's really important for people to know. You know, the deceased don't necessarily have any better smarts than us. They have to at least keep learning, at the very least. But if you... In the movie Ghost, I think is a really good example. In the movie Ghost, the character of Sam is actually trying to move things, and he ends up in the subway, New York subway. And Patrick Swayze's character is walking there, is going through the subway, and he sees this ghost running through the subway, knocking newspapers out of people's hands.
Mm-hmm.
And he asks the ghost how do you do that? And the ghost says, well, first, you got to know that you don't have hands. You don't have a body. You have to think, this has to be done with your mind, with your thought, because what you think is your body is only your mind.
You're here.
And so it truly is mind over matter, and that's something that's got to get through the, you know, the minds of the ghosts to begin with. We have had cases where there was significant object movement, and very deliberate, too. I had a case, it's not that active these days, a place called the Banta Inn out in Tracy, California,
right,
where when I got involved in the mid-'80s, it was still very active. The bartender owner had died in the late 60s, and he was apparently hanging around as a ghost. People had seen him, and he was fairly active on a physical level in terms of moving things, and he moved things for us for TV cameras, which was kind of fun. He liked to play with the customers quite a bit, which was also a lot of fun. In fact, the first time I was there, I was shooting an interview with Hard Copy, if you remember that old TV show.
Of course.
And the director and the cameraman had their backs to the bar, and I'm facing them, and there's a bartender and the owner at one end of the bar with one of the regulars, and there's nobody behind the bar or in the kitchen. And an ashtray behind the director pops up into the air in full view of me and everybody else except for the camera and the director. It flips over and smacks down on the bar. It was glass. It didn't break, though, but it smacked down on the bar and made a real big thud. And, of course, the camera caught the sound of that. The director said, "What was that?" And everybody started laughing. And the owner said, "Oh, that's what he does."
That's incredible. Absolutely incredible. I would so love to see it. Is there a way to see it? Are there YouTubes of this kind of thing being done?
If they can catch them on TV, on camera, sometimes you do see things. We had stuff happen for a Japanese crew. I have to see if I can dig through and find the factual footage we shot. It was a chandelier that they caught actually moving. I had seen it start moving, but the most impressive thing was that it stopped still when there was a psychic with us from Japan who had asked the ghost to stop it, and it stopped still instead of slowing down. We had a couple other things in another location for that. There is a show called Beyond Bizarre, which I think is on, the episode is actually on YouTube, covering the Banta Inn, and then at one point there's a placemat that did start shifting up on its own at the same time that there was some very interesting static on the video feed. Well,
you mentioned the Russians. They did a lot of this sort of research,
talk
about why. Did they document it?
They did. Well, you know, you can find video footage or YouTube footage of Nina Kulagina, N-I-N-A, Kulagina, K-U-L-I-G-A-N-A.
Really?
And also, she had two names. Nina Kulagina, I think her professional name was Nelia Mikhailova, but Kulagina is easier to find. And people have seen it. It's in use all the time. It's this black and white footage of this woman moving matches in a matchbox by moving her hands around. And people accused her of fraud with threads and such. And people were checking for that and apparently couldn't find that. Although she was caught at fraud, my understanding, through one of my colleagues, with a magnet in her bra at one point.
Oh.
However, the Russians... one of the things that, as I was reading the Russian accounts, they knew about that with the Kulagina. And what was interesting was they said that for the non-ferrous things, you know, the matches and things like that, she moved them by exuding almost like instead of sweat, she had a histamine. They actually analyzed this on her hands. Her hands kind of sprayed a histamine from her body. And that was subject to electrostatic fields, and then her body generated electrostatic fields, which we all can generate, and then moved the object. And one of my colleagues said, "Well, there you go, psychokinesis, explain it." I said, "Yeah, but how did her brain tell her body to exude a histamine and generate that at the right time?" That's still psychokinesis, which just gives a how that particular form of PK actually happened.
And then she ruined it with magnetic tatas. I would like Keith to hear this name again so we can go look on the web. Maybe we can get something on the website. The name again, please.
Nina, N-I-N-A, Kulagina, yes. Or Kulagina, K-U-L-A-G-I-N-A.
Okay, all right. We're going to break here. Keith, if you're able to find anything on the web, on YouTube or something, with something moving, I would love to see that. Absolutely love to see it. This is Dark Matter. AM Emerging Life Forms. Listen, everybody, how do you get a smartphone or a tablet to sound good? Answer is, you don't. They just don't sound good. I mean, they have little bitty speakers, and so they sound like they have little bitty speakers. But there is a way. It's called the Senta Ally Bluetooth speaker. What a really wonderful idea this is. And everybody who's bought one has been sending me email, and you're welcome to call me here on the show and tell me about it, because it's that good. It's Bluetooth. So it attaches itself to your phone or to your tablet, and then it plays your music, and it sounds like it's in a, you know, Radio City music hall place. Really rompin', stompin' good music. So I don't see how you cannot have one of these. We showed it to some people, and every time we did this, you know, demonstrated it, they immediately bought one. It's that kind of deal. It's that good. It's about 9 inches. It's an oval. You can actually literally put it in your pocket. Well, pretty good sized jacket pocket, I guess. And it works by streaming audio wirelessly from your smartphone or your tablet, and you enjoy full stereo sound that is really incredible. I mean, you could get people out there dancing to it, right? It's that good. It comes with a built-in FM radio, rechargeable battery pack that'll hang in there for up to 10 hours. This is really good stuff, folks. To order the Senta Ally Bluetooth speaker, and listen to this, it's only $69.95. Very, very affordable. Call C. Crane right now at 800-522-8863. That's 800-522-8863. If you would like to see before you buy, you can go to the ccrane.com website. And by the way, they're also available at amazon.com. I would much rather have you call Bob Crane and tell him that you heard it from Art Bell, please. 800-522-8863. Operators are there right now, probably sitting around waiting for calls. They never stand by. They just, you know, sit there. 1-800-522-8863. Professor Auerbach, welcome back.
Thank you.
You are an interesting guy. Really interesting. And then you do all this, and it says you're a chocolatier. What's up with mixing paranormal and chocolate? How does that happen?
Well, I mean, chocolate is probably the most sacred stuff on earth, of course. But we're talking about religion before, and in some respects, my wife and I consider foodism our religion. Foodism.
Really?
Yeah. So, being in Northern California, you can't help but be interested in wine. And the winery started carrying some artisan chocolate from Scharfenberger back in the late 90s. They were the first real American artisan chocolatier that was getting their stuff out there. And I hadn't had chocolate that good from the United States before, and it really kind of sent me on a path to learn to try different chocolates from the emerging chocolatier and chocolate maker market, the artisans here in the United States, but also to learn about chocolate a little bit more, about the food stuff, and all of its properties and its history. It just was an interesting thing for me. And as it happened, one of my publishers is having a conversation with a publisher for my book, A Paranormal Casebook, back in 2005. And I was in Dallas visiting her, and I brought with me several chocolate bars. We actually stopped and got some others at a nice store there, and I kind of told her all I had been picking up and learning. She said I ought to write a book. And the book would be about how to go from chocoholic to chocolate gourmet. And so I started thinking about that and started doing research on that, including doing guided chocolate tastings, kind of like a wine tasting for groups, and interviewing really well-respected chocolate makers here in the States, and especially here. We have a lot of really good chocolate makers here in the Bay Area. But I got some great advice from a chocolate maker named Joseph Schmidt, and that was that I should learn how to make chocolate if I really wanted to make the book good and figure it out. And I took a course to become a professional chocolatier and then came up with a product and really liked doing it. In fact, today what I was doing most of the day was making chocolate in a commercial kitchen nearby.
Wow. All right. It is my experience that we are told most things that we love that really, really taste good, delicious, and you crave them, they're not good for you.
Well, in chocolate's case, that is not true. Chocolate
really?
Is the most craved substance on the planet. That's by all polls, apparently.
I believe that. I believe it.
And, you know, maybe the sugar in it's not good for you, although if you have really dark chocolate, you don't get a lot of sugar to begin with. But the chocolate itself, every study that has been coming out of chocolate, of cacao, has shown positive benefits, health benefits for people. And where it's bad is if you eat too much of it, which is the same for anything, for that matter.
But it's so easy to do.
You know, if you have really high quality, higher percentage cacao chocolate, it's not easy to do. It's actually not, because a small piece of a good 70% chocolate is very satisfying. It's easy to scarf down a Milky Way bar, I can tell you that, or Three Musketeers or something, you know, a Snickers bar. Those are easy. Those are candy. But when you're talking about, there's a lot of flavor, there's an appetite, not a suppressant, but there's so many different components to chocolate, including not just caffeine, but theobromine, which is also a stimulant, and phenylethylamine, PEA, which is the substance in our brains that makes us feel like we're in love. So there really is a connection between chocolate and love. So it's a mood enhancer.
Oh, yes.
More importantly... I was going to say that Dean Radin, a few years ago, Dean Radin wrote Entangled Minds, and he did a study looking at whether chocolate with intention planted in it, this is a form of a psychokinesis experiment, but intentional chocolate, whether that would be more mood-enhancing and energizing than other chocolate. So they did a double-blind study, with four samples of chocolates from the same lot of chocolate produced by a chocolate maker in Hawaii with Hawaiian-grown cacao. And there was a control group, so there was one sub-sample that had nothing happen to it. One sample had Buddhist monks praying over it for 6 hours and putting an intention into it. They kept saying, this chocolate will be more mood-enhancing and will be more energizing. They had a Mongolian shaman who did a ceremony to put the same intention into his sample of chocolate. They had an intention circuit. Bill Goff here in the Bay Area claims to have a device that can record intention. And they had a Buddhist monk praying into the intention circuit, and then they put the chocolate in an isolation, a Faraday cage, with the intention circuit for an hour. And then this was all distributed to, this was a pilot study, so it wasn't a huge group of people, but it was distributed to different people who did not know what sample they were getting, and those poor people had to have a half an ounce of chocolate at 10 o'clock in the morning and a half an ounce of chocolate at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And they had to fill out a mood survey before and after each sample that they had, and when Dean got the data back, he did not know which group was which. Three of the groups were 67% higher in mood enhancement than one of the groups. And the one group that was low was the control group.
Well, I can tell you, just talking about chocolate makes me want it. In other words, as I listen to you discuss, dark chocolate, my mind went to work on that. I'm thinking, boy, would that be good right now.
Yeah, it's always important to have some around.
I wonder if when you pass to the other side, things like chocolate or the craving for chocolate remains with you. Might seem like a silly question, but I bet it's not.
No, you know, I'm just hoping that food is still there in some way, shape, or form. I hope that we still have a form of chocolate, even if it's mentally getting the sense of chocolate over there.
Right. Well, I hope radio's over there. You know, I'm so in love with the radio. I mean, whatever it is in your life, for heaven to be heaven, as we probably all think of it, you know, exactly what you want. I mean, just paradise for you. Paradise is no single thing. It's different things to different people, so there's got to be radio there, my point of view.
Right. Yeah. That's right.
By the way, since we're moving in that direction, do you have a sense, Professor, of what the other side is like?
You know, that's a good question, and I know it's a question that's going to come up at our afterlife conference for the Forever Family Foundation next month.
Absolutely.
Kind of a central question. You know, in fact, that's the question I was supposed to address in my lecture, my presentation at the end of everybody else's presentations. You know, I have an anthropology undergraduate, and I did a lot of cross-cultural, you know, review of psychic experiences and such as part of that, and I continue to do that. And there are all sorts of afterlife beliefs. And, you know, I'm kind of torn between the idea that we all create our own afterlife, kind of like what we saw in the movie What Dreams May Come, which was a much better book by the late Richard Matheson, that we kind of create our own.
Great book, actually. Great book.
His stuff was, he was probably the most knowledgeable horror and science fiction writer about the paranormal of anybody in history. Absolutely amazingly knowledgeable about the subject. But I think that I'm torn between that and just simply saying, and this is in all honesty and not being flip at all again here, that it just may be something we can't even envision because we won't be with bodies over there. So no. We don't even have a frame of reference for how cool it will be.
Well, it rules out all kinds of things, beginning with sex.
As we know it.
And as we know it, right?
Yeah, I don't. So I think it's kind of one of those. It's questions of. I hope it's fun. Hope it's good. I'm not in a hurry to get there, but.
Right, there's no chocolate. There is no sex.
I sure as hell hope there is chocolate. Yeah.
If
otherwise I'll have to come back and possess some chocolate maker somewhere.
Yeah, but disembodied spirits, right?
Right.
So. But on getting very serious for a second, a person like yourself who has dealt with so many psychics probably has formed something of a picture of the environment of the other side.
You know, most of the mediums and most of the communications that people have tend to favor, and I just don't know if this is the case. I mean, I'd like to think this is. They tend to favor a very pleasant. Very similar to our world universe in another dimension that where people carry on with their lives, but they don't really age, and there's no illness, and it's kind of like an infinite world.
I mean, are we talking about well-groomed gated communities here, or what?
I've never heard gated communities, but the idea that people can kind of affect things and. In their immediate world is very much part of this, and that people who perhaps we would consider evil in this life have to face up to their sins over there, but that they do that, you know, not through punishment, but basically being confronted with their own sins. I think it's kind of like defending your life.
Sure.
In that way.
Huh.
And of course, very.
Then here's another one for you. I'm sorry to be barraging you with all this stuff, but it's a question that, I've discussed with some of the women who have been in my life. You know, if you live long enough, you will have loved any number of times. One of the things that I guess is a central tenet in the other side, or thinking about the other side, is that you get to be with the ones you love, right?
Right, right.
Well, if you have loved a number of times... Well, who do you get to?
That's a good question. Yeah, I do know where you're going with that. And of course, we assume that they have loved a lot of times too.
That's a good point. Yes.
So maybe you're going to end up with the person you most loved and who most loved you. You know, where there's the greatest connection.
So the others can get angry and pound walls.
The others probably have their own people that they connect with.
They have walls up there.
If they have walls, yeah, but they probably have their own people that they're connecting with, too. And that's to say that there's some people may get reincarnated, too, because that's one thing that we do research in this field, and it seems that some people do come back, so there may be that, too.
Let's go right there, reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that, for example, in Thailand, they very, very, very much believe in reincarnation. And there's, frankly, perhaps a pretty good case for reincarnation. I have heard that reincarnation at one time was in the Bible and got, I don't know, redacted.
I think redacted is a good word. Yeah, actually, the early versions of the New Testament, of the Gospels, do have reincarnation as one of the teachings. It's one of the things that was excised. I don't recall which. I've read a bit of the history. I think it was the same Catholic Congress that decided that Jesus was divine as opposed to just a prophet. You know, that was decided by a pope.
Right. I think it was the Council of Nicaea, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the Council of Nicaea, yeah. And I thought, from my understanding, is the council actually said that he wasn't, and the Pope said he was, and the Pope kind of won. So it was there. It's believed by more than a billion people on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It is something that we have really, really strong evidence that something like reincarnation is definitely happening. Ian Stevenson's people, he was the kind of the lead on this through the University of Virginia, but Jim Tucker is there now, and Erlendur Haraldsson over at the University of Iceland has been doing this kind of work for a long time as well, working with kids who remember past lives. And in circumstances where there's no way they could know enough about the person that they claim to have been, given the environment, the socialization, no YouTube, you know, no Facebook, no computers, no phones in some parts of the world where they were doing finding this. And some of these cases are just mind-blowing. They're absolutely amazing cases. And we've had many cases here in the United States as well. It's harder to find them here in the States because parents don't want to bring this out with their kids because they're afraid the kids are going to be ridiculed. And, you know, it's culturally, it's very, very tough to find parents.
Okay. Well, let me tell you what I've done in past years. I have interviewed doctors, professor, who have inadvertently, in the process of hypnosis for either medical or social reasons, like trying to get somebody to quit smoking or whatever, have regressed people. And I've talked to some doctors who swear up and down with what they claim is proof that they have accidentally regressed people back into a prior life. And then they became so interested that they did this more and more and more and actually began questioning people about their prior lives and getting evidence that could be brought forward to prove it was true. You know about this?
Yeah, I mean, there's a basic problem with hypnotic regression. There are some cases in hypnotic regression which provide enough fine detail that they seem to be very indicative of a reincarnation. Most past life regression is not. Most past life regression, you know, it's not done accidentally. There's many, many people. It's a form of therapy, for that matter. But there are many people who go to a hypnotherapist and they want to be regressed to a past life. And the very act of saying you're going back before you were born actually can generate a past life story from the individual. A colleague of mine who is a hypnotherapist has done thousands of regressions as part for therapeutically and for other reasons. And one of the things he would do in the regression to see if he had a case, you know, is this person who's talking about a past life, could this really be a past life? And he'd ask him fine details like, okay, so you're a 12th century French farmer. Where'd you poop?
Yeah.
What'd you have for breakfast? What was your diet like? What was your daily? Describe your day. You know, things that the average person could never have ever read about or seen in a movie.
Right.
Because there is something that Ian Stevenson noted called cryptomnesia, which is the idea that we have seen and read so much stuff over the years, from schooling through movies to novels, it's all lodged in our unconscious. It's lodged there. So we have enough information to create a past life very easily that can be very convincing. But we don't have those fine details because unless you're a history major majoring in 12th century France, you're not going to know how to answer those questions.
Well, do you think any of it is real?
I do. I don't know what it means. It certainly indicates a form of reincarnation, whether it is the spirit or soul of the person that is being reborn or something else from that person, a memory, you know, some sort of really intense memory engram or something else. It's definitely not genetic because this happens with families that have no connection whatsoever, and it happens fairly quickly, too, which is the interesting thing. Most reincarnations in most parts of the world that the researchers have found, there's an average of 15 months before conception of the death of the person. And that's not a lot of time.
No.
And it's often less than that. It's often a lot less than that. So, you know, it's not like suddenly information can genetically transfer over, unless, of course, the person's directly... it's their own son or something like that. But it doesn't work from any other perspective, except, as some of my colleagues like to say, it's some form of super ESP, which I completely disagree with.
Well, the Book of Death, seems to describe a process in which you go through this real scary thing. You actually get to see the parents that you're going to have and so forth and so on. I mean, it's really wild, and a lot of people believe in all this.
Sure. Sure. It's in the in-between time. You get to choose all that.
That's right.
There are different cultures that believe, have variations of how this all happens. I wrote a book on reincarnation back in the 90s.
Oh.
And found, it was really interesting talking to one of my colleagues, Jim Matlock, actually described, and then there's another one named Antonia Mills, who both described how different groups have different attitudes about who gets reincarnated where. So, you know, one group will believe that they can only be reincarnated in non-family members, and the other group believes that they can only be reincarnated in family members, you know, within the family. And that seems to be what's reported. And it could be a reporting artifact, but it actually could be what's actually going on in that vicinity.
So the idea, I believe, is to keep improving. As your soul comes back again and again, you're supposed to keep getting better, or at least that's the goal, right?
Well, that's if you're going for the karmic idea, that's the idea of reincarnation.
Yes.
Yeah, that's
yes.
right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I always wondered how that works, because there are no conscious memories of prior lives in order to correct, right?
Yeah, I'm with you on that. That's one of the things that's always puzzled me about that idea, too, that you know, that you're trying to relive your life. It only would mean, it would have to mean that your unconscious is guiding you for certain actions that you consciously can't remember, but your unconscious can. And actually, if you can regress someone, you're tapping into the unconscious at that point anyway. So that would be an indicator that the unconscious does know something that the conscious doesn't.
Well, the whole concept is, you know, on the table as good as anybody else's, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Listen, hold tight, Professor. Whew, good stuff. Professor Auerbach is my guest, Lloyd Auerbach, and we'll continue this evening, and we'll get to the phones pretty soon. So if you have questions, we'll be there for you. And if you don't have questions, well, I've got to wonder about you a little bit. If you dare, indeed. Just got some kind of disturbing news on the wormhole. There's been a 7.1 earthquake, or perhaps 7.5, in the southern Philippines. That's where my wife's family is. 4 dead reported so far, but that's pretty serious, 7.5 in Bohol, I understand. So, certainly that's not good news. Professor, welcome back to the program.
Sure. Sorry to hear about that.
Yes. Do you think that there are psychics that can predict that kind of thing, you know, large earth events like earthquakes, tsunamis, that sort of thing?
Yeah, you know, not to the precision that we would like, I think. They certainly have been able to predict events in certain areas, but to the timing and the precision that's necessary to really make any difference has not actually happened yet, at least not that I've heard of.
I see. Well,
you know, the one thing about it's really important to know that I know people want to see psychics for predictions of the future, but the better psychics will tell you that even with earthquakes, you know, the future is, I guess you could say, always in motion, as Yoda would say. It's not easy to get a lot of information back for a very specific event. So
But put it another way, would you say the future is malleable?
A lot of it is, yeah. We could change it, sure. You can't change the earthquake necessarily, but you can change. But the question is going to be: does the earthquake happen? Like, if it's a 7.5 deep in the middle of the Pacific and it does nothing more than create some, you know, some seismographic action, then there's not a human reaction to it, and the psychics wouldn't pick up on it at all. My guess is that somebody probably picked up on that earthquake, but the problem is it doesn't do any good unless you know exactly where it is and when it's going to strike.
Would you personally consult a psychic? Can you imagine reason why you would? Oh,
yeah.
You have, okay.
I have.
On a personal basis now.
On a personal basis, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and in a couple of ways. One has been, you know, just getting some clarity on things that are going on to help me more information to help me make some decisions, which I make myself. I don't go by what the psychic may tell me what looks best, but I still have to weigh the information. If all I get is do this, not that, that doesn't tell me anything. I want to know why I would do this, not that. I need the background about that. And the other is I've been to mediums to check them out, and they have communicated with family members, my family members, or people that was very close to who have passed on. And very
curious. And you felt it valid?
Absolutely. And more importantly, it helped me quite a bit. I did that after my father died with a psychic I knew and had worked with for years, with Annette Martin. And she never met my father, but she picked up on very specific things about him. And I got some – it wasn't resolution I was looking for, because honestly, I was in the hospital when he passed, and I sensed him passing. I mean, I knew he was there, and in fact, we had something happen in the waiting room. Yeah, we were – my mother, one of my brothers, and I were heading back to the waiting room after they kind of called it. He was in the ICU, and they basically took him off everything because his organs were failing. And I sensed him there, and I sensed him kind of moving away. And then we went to the waiting room to wait for my other brother to come up from Brooklyn to where we were in Westchester County. And as we walked, this is about 5 o'clock in the morning, we walked into the waiting room, and the TV came on, and it changed channel to a hockey game, to a sports channel. And my father was a sports producer. And there was no one else in the waiting room, and it was not on a timer, and it wasn't exactly 5 o'clock. So, I checked all those things out. So I felt like it was him. But still, I just wanted to, to still have a kind of a last goodbye kind of
thing. Sure.
As well. And it felt good to do that.
That's quite a story. There are those who believe, and I'm one of them, that when somebody passes, for a number of, I know it may sound silly, but for a number of days, their presence, there's still some presence here on Earth, and then they may move on at some point, but there's something left here for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Any validity to that, do you think?
Well, first, when people talk about ghosts or seeing a ghost or having an experience, 99.9% of all ghostly encounters happen when a relative, friend, or loved one has just passed.
Right.
And either at the moment of death or within a few days. It's usually within 48 to 72 hours, but it can be for a week or so. They report seeing him, seeing her, smelling their perfume. They report an encounter, and it's really kind of a last goodbye kind of encounter. I'm stopping by to say goodbye. That's thousands and thousands and thousands of people over the last 130 years of my field. It's tens of thousands, if not millions of people who we've heard about. So many people have these experiences around the world. So, I'm with you on that for sure. And it may depend on the person and how many people they need to say goodbye to, and it's probably up to them how long they stay. My friend Martin Caden, who had done the PK work that I work with, always kidded me. He ended up with terminal cancer. He outlasted what the Mayo Clinic said he would live by by over a year and a half. He was pissed off at them for telling him how long he had to live. he had always said, I'm going to come back and haunt you. And I kind of wish he did. And so after he died, I kind of, expected to see him or have an experience in the first couple of days. And nothing happened. Nothing happened for a week. Week and a half goes by. I was driving to the Oakland airport early in the morning to fly up to Portland, Oregon for some business. And my new car, the car was only a couple months old, still smelled like a new car, filled up with the smell of stinky cigar smoke, which I recognized as his. And I felt a presence sitting in the passenger seat. And I, had a conversation. I knew it was him. And I had a conversation, said my goodbyes, and it disappeared. And this was at 7 o'clock in the morning. I get up to Portland. I call one of Marty's pilot friends, who I knew pretty well, who's living in New Jersey. I'd met the guy a bunch of times in Florida when I visited Marty. And as I say, hey, Bob, it's Lloyd Auerbach. And he says, Lloyd, you must be psychic. And, of course, I said, yes, I am. Well, why do you think that, Bob? He says, because Caden was with me this morning. And he proceeded to talk about flying his Cessna at around 10 o'clock in the morning Eastern time About 10:10, his cockpit filled up with the smell of stinky cigar smoke, and he described exactly the same experience I had 10 minutes later than me. So it was 10:10 Eastern Time, which is 7:10 Pacific. And then he said he had spoken to another pilot friend of Marty's who apparently at 10:20 Eastern Time had the exact same experience. And over the next couple of weeks, Bob and I spoke to a number of other people. It was probably a couple dozen people had the exact experience, either in a car or in a plane.
Okay, I have a question for you. You said you had a conversation with him.
Yeah, one-sided.
One-sided. Okay,
yeah,
thank you.
Yeah.
That clarifies.
Yeah, I didn't hear anything. I just, you know, I'm sure people thought I was just simply singing or something as they drove by me.
That's okay, Lloyd. I've had conversations too, and you know, I'm a great skeptic, but I guess not that much of a skeptic because I've had those conversations. I usually try to do it alone in the car or wherever, but I've had them, and I feel they're useful, and I feel they're heard.
Right, right. And
now,
I think that's the important thing, too.
Yeah, well, lots of people out there would say, oh, come on, this is just how the human mind deals with grieving, and, you know, there could be something to that. I don't know.
Well, I to them, I would say, so what? Then why are you so upset when I say that, you know, that this is a good thing?
Well, it is a good thing. Whether
yeah.
it's good for just me or it's good on both sides, who knows, but it's a good thing.
Right, right.
Okay. What have I not touched on tonight that you would like to get in, some area that we haven't touched on yet?
Well, let's talk, first of all, you know, going back to the TV shows and the whole Ghost Hunter community, let's talk a little bit about education, because it's kind of what I am. I think I'm known as an investigator, but I would like to think of myself as an educator as much as anything else.
Sure.
With all the courses I teach, and that's partly why I'm so involved with some of these organizations, because they do have outreach to people who have interest, and they are trying to educate people of all types in what's really going on in the field and what we think we're dealing with here. And I just want to say that if people have an interest, they should actually seek out some of these organizations, because there's a wealth of information. The Forever Family Foundation has a wealth of information just in the interviews that they've done with people over the years, and the conference coming up is really a wonderful annual conference with both scientists and psychics, so it's kind of a combination of those two. The Rhine Research Center, which I am on the board of, does really great work. Of course, this is the legacy of Dr. J.B. Rhine, who's the father of modern parapsychology. It's in Durham, North Carolina. And people are surprised to find that when they become members of this, there's this huge video library of all the lectures that they've had for the last couple of years, because they have biweekly, you know, every other week they do lectures and workshops and really big names and really great subjects, and they've had remote viewing workshops from Ed May and Joe McMonagle. McMonagle was the number one viewer for the Stargate program.
I've talked to him.
Yeah, I mean, you've probably talked to every single person they have had speak there, in fact.
I think I probably have, yes.
Yeah, and there, the lectures are there, and people can actually join in, and it's a benefit of membership. And these organizations have so little money, they're nonprofit, they want to do more research, they want to do more outreach, they want to do more education, and it really is important for people to kind of put their money where their mouths are, and it doesn't have to be very much at all, for that matter. The Rhine Center offers classes, online classes. I'm involved with some of those beside my own classes, which I do for educational purposes. And Winbridge is another great organization that helps support. They're looking at the place of mediumship in the grieving process, as is the Forever Family Foundation. There are now studies that show that mediums have a positive impact on the grieving process. And considering the lack of grief therapy that's out there, there's very few people who know anything about grief therapy other than that five steps of grief, which apparently has been disavowed by psychology these days. So really, people looking for the organizations can start with places like my website, which is mindreader.com, or the Rhine website, which is Rhine, R-H-I-N-E.org, or even the Parapsychological Association, which is the organization of scientists in the field, which people can support as well, and that's just simply parapsych.org. We have a lot of really great organizations out there that do some really interesting things. And it's a very small field, so we all know each other pretty well.
I know this. I know that if you block it out, if you don't grieve, you're making a horrible mistake, because trust me, it will come back and get you.
Right.
So that grieving process really has to happen, doesn't it? And better sooner than later.
Absolutely, it really does. And whether it's one form of therapy or another, you need to address it. And, you know, I hear some of the skeptics and debunkers talk about how it's a lot of BS and it's hurting people for them to see a medium. You know, it may be hurting somebody if they have to go to a medium every week. That's crazy. That's obsessive compulsive behavior. It's something else than just grieving at that point. But there's something very therapeutic about being able to say goodbye. Even if it was a fake, it's still very therapeutic. So for them to really deny that this is a positive effect without actually looking at the data that shows it's not negative, it's actually positive. Yeah, it's just what science is doing, because there's this materialist perspective that just cannot allow for consciousness to be anything but what they think it is.
Okay, well, here's a practical question for you, and it really is a practical question. If somebody has recently lost someone and they want to go to a legitimate medium, how do they find a legitimate medium? Is there some sort of, Annie's List?
Kind of. There kind of is, and I think you're asking the right question, because that is an important question. And there is the Forever Family Foundation and the Winbridge Organization, winbridge.org, both have lists of certified mediums, mediums they've vetted. These mediums will work by phone and by Skype.
Okay. Okay,
Absolutely. In fact, what's really interesting is one of the things that Julie Beischel found by working with some of these mediums in her extremely controlled conditions, that very often they were even better the further away from the person they were when they did the reading.
Really? Really?
Yeah. There's a wonderful medium I met and have started working with who comes over to the United States every so often for vacation, from Ireland, a woman named Sandra O'Hara. She's in Dublin, and she works by Skype. She's mind-blowingly good. I mean, she hasn't gone through the certification program just because she's in Ireland, but she's really, really good and very compassionate. Most of these people, you know, when you talk to most of the mediums that are certified for either organization, you would not know that these were psychics or mediums unless they happened to mention it. They're very normal, down-to-earth people, and that's very contrary to what you see on TV. They come across as normal, average people for the most part. Now, there are exceptions who are you know, extraordinary personalities. Teresa Caputo, the Long Island medium, actually is certified by the Forever Family Foundation. She's a character. But then I know a lot of people from Queens who are just like her. So
yes, indeed. All right. So there are filters. There are ways.
Yeah.
And, of course, when you're grieving, I guess it's pretty tough to stop and do this kind of research before finding whoever it is you're going to find, but it sounds like an awfully good idea. All right, I've got some questions for you. For example, I have this computer where I get these questions. Can Lloyd please further explain the reasoning behind why someone who does not want to get better in health, can't be healed or helped by psychokinesis or any other method?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, and actually it relates partly to the mind-body connection, which is, you know, a lot of people in medicine say they don't really think about that much, and yet they will prescribe a placebo, which effectively is a mind-body relation medicine, if you want to call it that. We have probably a greater effect on our own bodies than a healer ever could. We're good at making our bodies feel bad. You know, psychosomatic illnesses are illnesses caused by stress or by psychology of the person, but they are physiological changes. They're actual physical illnesses.
Absolutely.
So
I know that.
Yeah.
This is going to be a crazy question. Can you do preventative health care with your mind?
Should be able to. You absolutely should be able to. Yep. People claim to be able to do that. People have, you know, there's been the research on visualization in cancer that some people are successful at, some people are not.
Right, right.
So you have...
I was told, Professor, for example, at night when you go to bed, just take some time, envision white light moving through your body and healing anything that needs to be healed. In other words, bringing health to you. That
sure.
This kind of thinking is a positive, real thing that can work?
You know, it definitely will help. You know, the light itself, it's the intention that you've got and the attitude that you've got. There's that old adage that laughter is the best medicine. Laughter actually is good for you. There's studies that show that laughing is a good thing health-wise for your body. So, you know, there are things that make us feel better mood-wise and emotionally actually have a positive impact on our health.
It's amazing. That's really amazing.
That's us affecting our own bodies. That's not somebody else affecting our bodies. That's us affecting our own bodies.
So you actually can think yourself healthy or think yourself sick?
Yeah, it's probably easier to think yourself sick than healthy.
Why?
Well, because there's so many other things impinging on us, on our health, stress-wise, especially in the given work environment that most people have today.
That's true. Boy, is that true. All right, by the way, from Keith Rowland, my website guy, he said, first featured item on the homepage now is a Nina Tube YouTube video. He may find a better one soon, but it's up there right now. So if you want to, we referenced it earlier.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to see one of them, I guess he's found one. He'll find more.
There are tons of them, actually, yeah.
Yeah, artbell.com, and he's going to get them up there. I want to see them myself. Seeing somebody actually physically move something under controlled circumstances, it seems to me, would change your life forever. Kind of like seeing a UFO in person.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be the same after you've seen this.
If you accept it, and let's face it, people will look at that like they've looked at UFOs and completely take that as, oh yeah, that's just simply, you know, it's not really, it's not real.
No, trust me. If you'd seen what I'd seen, you would have no problem with that. Other people might, but I know what I saw, and
yeah.
It wasn't.
No, I know. What I'm saying is, it's different for different people. I think that there are a lot of people who see unusual things, and they actually don't see them, and they almost have a cognitive dissonance where their brain goes blank, and they don't actually see it because it's such a confrontation to their own paradigm of things. That's why some of the skeptics and disbelievers, the debunkers, have such a hard time. They can be shown a research paper right in front of them. They say, well, that's not real. It's nothing there.
How hard is it being in academia and dealing with this sort of thing? How hard is it?
It's very hard. And, you know, frankly, I have a degree in parapsychology. Back when in the 80s, there was a degree program, master's program in parapsychology at John F. Kennedy University. I could not go to most universities and teach with that degree because they would say, well, that doesn't count. Because and I've had people tell me that parapsychology is not a real field, so that doesn't count.
Wow. Why are we behind? Why were the Russians so much more involved and may still be in these fields of research than we are here in the U.S.?
Cultural thing. Yeah, it's a cultural thing, and even the sciences have a slight cultural difference over there. Yeah, you know, and the Chinese especially have a big cultural difference in how they approach things. And that's, you know, it's partly a philosophical background. It's the history of the country and the religions that are there, and they have a very different approach to things instead of the Western empirical model that came out of very strict 19th century Victorian England.
We still are pretty Victorian here in a lot of ways, aren't we?
We sure are, especially in the sciences. Yeah.
I don't understand that. And I'm going to give you an example. Here in the U.S., although gays have made certainly big strides in recent years, there is still an awful lot of discrimination against gays, to be frank. And I went and I lived for years in the Philippines. And you would think in the Philippines, which is mainly Catholic, a lot more Catholic than we are, there would be a big problem with gays. But, oh, guess what? Just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
They're not even noticed. I mean, gays are everywhere, and people don't even bat an eyelash. So there's some profound difference that I've been trying to figure out and can't.
It may be our puritanical background that, you know, this country was colonized first by the Puritans and people like that. So there may be a little bit of that. you know, you find the same kind of thing in other areas too as well, just looking around the world and how people accept certain things as normal that we don't accept as normal in this country. And,
oh, boy, is that right.
Yeah.
All right, Professor, hold on. We're going to take a break here. I hope it would be okay to open the lines and take some calls.
Sure, absolutely.
All right, and I hope those would be good calls. So, folks, please be polite and try and ask, I don't know, on-the-spot questions. Certainly, you've got a very wide field to choose from in terms of what you can ask. So we're going to clear the lines right now and open them. Again, it's an easy number, a very easy number, 855-REAL-UFO. Or if you want the numbers, 855-732-5836. Professor Lloyd Auerbach is my guest. What a show, huh? I'm Art Bell. Morning, morning, whatever the case is, where you are. Professor Lloyd Auerbach is my guest. And if it gets any better than this, I'm not sure how that happens. You're welcome to call 855-REAL-UFO if you have a question. Somebody wrote on here, you know, music really sets the mood. You think? Professor, a couple of questions from my computer screen that are really good ones. This comes from Linda. My father died from Alzheimer's. Do you believe that when they leave the body, they have their mind back right away?
Yeah, I do. I do. In fact, people have reported deathbed changes in people. You know, there's something where we call them deathbed apparitions, where someone who is dying actually has a moment where they have clear lucidity and they'll start talking to someone, like a spouse or somebody. They actually see someone coming to take them away,
right,
in a very positive way. And I've known, I've talked to people at hospices and other places who've told me that even Alzheimer's patients will have incredible lucidity and even be able to carry on a conversation with the people around them while this is actually happening. And then they,
right,
then they go back into that state, and then they pass away. So,
wow,
it's, you know, you can think of the body as a bad TV set, and the signal is consciousness. So a TV set does, you know, if you're trying to watch a TV set and you have a problem with the TV set, that doesn't affect the signal. It affects how you interface with the signal.
Yes, sir.
So,
all right. Now this is Deepak, I guess, after Chopra. Please ask the professor about EVPs. Now, I have had some guests on my shows, and of all the things that I've done that are, if you will, haunting and chilling to me, EVPs are, boy, are they in that category. It's been for years and years we've been doing shows on this, and I've got a group who really has been great up in Utah with EVPs. And is there something to this phenomena?
Well, there is. The question is, what is happening?
Yes.
Especially in individual EVPs. There is an element, if it's done appropriately, correctly, then it may or may not be spirit communication. We do know that living people can affect things, and it's really interesting that groups, the ghost hunting groups and that I've talked to and people have talked to over the across the country, there's a unique thing that's going on. And then as you have five people in the group, and one person consistently gets EVP, but the rest don't in the same location.
Uh-huh.
And
right,
so that would indicate that there's something about that person. Now, whether they are creating the EVP themselves, which is possible, through their expectation, that would be PK, whether the ghost is, if there's a ghost present, an apparition present, they might be working with that person. The person may be unconsciously a medium of sorts. I coined the term techno-medium. So they're not aware that they're a medium between the dead and the technology, but they are still kind of an intermediary in some way, shape, or form. But there's really good EVPs, and there's a thing that's less known, and that is I've heard EVPs from folks that in locations where we have that place memory. In other words, there's that recording, that tape,
right,
the residual
right
stuff. And the EVP is more than just a voice. It's like, you know, crowd sounds and a gunshot and horses and things like that. So,
oh, yes,
it's likely that the person, again, we have a techno medium, the person operating the recording device didn't realize it, but he was helping to facilitate the recording of a bit of place memory. instead of an apparition trying to communicate.
Okay, let's go to the phones and give it a shot here. Hi, this is Dark Matter, and you're on the air.
Yeah.
Yes. Hello.
Yeah, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Okay. You're a little weak, but go ahead.
Okay, Mitty Roswell, Art. My wife passed away in 05, and I had three psychic feelings that went through me shortly after her death. And the thing that I was, I wanted to ask the question was, how can I build my psychic abilities up more? Because I've always sort of been a little bit psychic. And after she died, I was sitting at the computer, and I verbally talked to her, wondering where a book was. And then an hour or so later, I got up from the computer, and I walked down the hall, and I suddenly stopped, reached on the shelf, and got the book. And it was like she guided me right there to that book. And then a week or so later, I was looking for some insurance papers, and I heard it in my head that she said, you know, I was a good bookkeeper. Go in there and sit down at the desk and look in the front of the filing cabinet, right in the front corner, and you'll find the insurance paper. And I'm sitting there going, I don't believe this. And I got up, walked in there, and found it.
And okay, it's a very, very good point you're making, Professor. These kinds of messages are received after loved ones pass, and I don't know what kind of explanation there is for them other than the obvious.
Yeah, I mean, he's clearly open to her communication, and that's an important thing, probably because of the emotional connection the two of them shared.
Sure.
His question is about developing his abilities further. In this case, what we've got so far is the wife's intention to communicate and him being open. And I think the openness to that communication will probably open him up to other kinds of experiences as well. And the thing to do, it's really interesting. A psychic I worked with years ago at the American Society for Psychical Research, who was our research psychic, Alex Tanis, said that the first step in becoming psychic is to notice that you already are. And that's something that I took to heart, and it's something I teach in my classes. I mean, one of the classes I teach is a class called Being Psychic, and it's one of my distance learning classes, too. And it's really about first noting what kind of experience you've had and really being aware, going forward, of these experiences of information that don't fit your normal senses and keeping track of them so that you can really get a sense of when do they happen, under what conditions do they happen, and really focusing in those directions for getting that kind of information and that communication going.
All right, but refocusing on something you said earlier, you know, we did talk about, can you become better? Can you become a better psychic? You kind of said no.
No, you can become a better psychic. It's just that you may hit a wall into how well you can do at some certain task.
Okay, so there is a way to get better. Recognizing that you have that ability is, I guess, the big jump, huh?
It's the big jump, and then figuring out what you're good at is the next step.
All right. Allie in California, you're on the air with Professor Auerbach.
Hi, Art. Major Roswell's to you. I've been listening to you since I was 10 years old.
God.
Anyways, me and my dad would drive the Blue Diamond Highway every night and listen to you on the radio, and I'm so glad you're back. I drive nightly every day, and I'm good to hear you. Anyways, Lloyd, I was wondering, I would be so into the hypnosis that you were talking about how to find out your past life.
Right, right.
When I was about 15 years old, I kept telling my mom, I don't feel like I belong here. I don't feel like I belong in this era. I feel like I'm supposed to be born at a different time. And she goes, that is so funny that you said that, because when you were young, you used to talk about the things you did when you were an adult. Like when I was really little, she would say, you would come to me and say, when I was 35, I rode a motorcycle from California to New York.
Oh, my.
Things that I wouldn't know when I was 5 years
old. Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing that the kids remember past lives do talk about.
And my mom would say it a lot. She said I would tell people things random people about things I would have done when I was an adult. And even to this day, I've been told, I'm 25, and I've been told I have an old soul. Mm-hmm. And people who don't even know me will look at me and say, you have an old soul. And I work with the public, and so I deal with people a lot. And it takes me off guard because I've always felt that I didn't belong in this era, that I was from a different time. And it's funny because I told my husband that, and he feels the exact same way, that we're just from a different time,
yeah,
a different place. And I would really want to do some sort of hypnosis, because I believe in hypnosis.
Sure.
Like hypnobirthing and stuff like that to get rid of pain. But also, like, just to go back into my brain and just to see what things I have, like, suppressed since I was little.
Do you, Professor, recommend that? Is that, if somebody wants to do it, is it fine? Go back,
oh, sure.
Take me back?
Yeah, I mean, it's fine, especially since it can be very, it can be very therapeutic, and there's no reason not to do it. what I would suggest doing is you can send me an email, either through my website, mindreader.com, or just to profparanormal@gmail.com, and I'm happy to hook you up with a friend. The person who runs the school where I teach is very active in the Association for Past Life Therapists.
Would you be kind enough to say that email address?
Sure.
Slowly.
I will do that. It is prof, as in professor, profparanormal, all one word, no dots, @gmail.com.
Okay.
And then if they go to mindreader.com, it's easy to find me that way, too.
profparanormal@gmail.com.
Yep. And I'm happy to recommend, put you in touch with someone who can recommend someone for you.
Good luck, Professor. Okay. You're on the air with Professor Auerbach. Hi.
Hello, Art.
Yes, hello.
Hi, this is Hal from Maryland.
Yes, Hal.
Hi. Well, first I have to tell you, I've been many Roswells to you.
Thank you.
I've been listening to you since the 90s. I went through the Millennium Crisis with you. I'm sitting
all here. Right, now let me stop you for a second. Once somebody says Roswells or many Roswells or even mega Roswells, you probably ought to stop there because that says it all. Please proceed.
Yeah, I'm sitting here looking at years of birthday presents. I have a Sea Crane Radio Plus. I have a Sea Crane Wi-Fi.
I'm not going to stop you, but
a portable, and it was just my birthday in September, and now I have the Bluetooth.
Okay. Oh, really? All right. I will ask you about that. How do you like it?
Well, I am listening to you on my cell phone over Sirius XM satellite because I signed up free for a month, and
right.
It is mega, mega sound. It's amazing.
Thank you. Are you hearing this, everybody? All right, now, the professor is our guest, so you should ask him a question.
Well, most of my life I've always thought that we're born with all of the knowledge in the world as an infant, and we just don't have any way to be able to use that knowledge. And as we get older, we lose those memories, and we just become normal. And after listening to past life and everything, I think I changed what I think, and I think what we're born with is all the knowledge of our past person. And as we age, we start to lose that. And I'm wondering really whether, you know, past life regression hypnotherapy really works. And I'm glad that Lloyd said that what we ought to do if I do try that is to get specifics of...
Mm-hmm.
Where do you go to the bathroom? What do you eat? You know, what was your day like? Because now I'll know if it really means anything when I actually do this.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's important to... Hypnotic regression seems to work on occasion. Because it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody's not been reborn from past lives, but it does tend to point, for the most part, the hypnosis tends to bring up... unconscious stories as opposed to actual past lives. So, you know, when I mentioned that my friend asked those mundane questions, he then has to research. He has to go to a library like UCLA Library, and he has to research the 12th century farmers and see if, in fact, what that person said about where they went to the bathroom and what they ate, if that's actually true. So it's actually a two-part process, and it helps
if that's what you're going for, try to understand what the past life was. It helps to do that. But as a tool to understand yourself, past life regression is really a cool thing. And people have gotten very, very therapeutic results from it. It's considered a brief therapy for some people, in fact.
Professor, I've got a theory. Are you willing to listen?
Sure.
You know, when you have a dream at night, even a pretty striking dream, if you don't either talk about it with somebody immediately or write it down, it quite quickly fades into the ether, and an hour or so after you're awake, you don't remember it even a little, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. For most people, right. For most people.
Is it possible that when you're born, this caller said, you're born with all this information from some prior life or prior lives, and is it not possible that as you grow up as a child, kind of like in a dream, you start forgetting all of this information that was in your little baby brain?
Oh, it's certainly possible. And in fact, what's interesting is that in the majority of these cases of kids who remember past lives, not all of them, majority of them, by about age 6, they start forgetting the past life. And it's like as if the current personality firmly reasserts itself and firmly comes in. And as they go further in the life, some of them don't even remember even talking to their parents about having had a past life.
Yes, and I have a 6-year-old. And at about 6, you start replacing those with memories that will be with you when you grow up.
Right. Right. That's correct. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Very, very interesting. You're on the air. This would be Bob in Canada somewhere. Hi. Bob? Bob in Canada or Indiana?
Indiana. Bogey.
Sorry. I read the line above.
Hey, Megas Roosevelt, do you like?
Thank you.
And I was wondering if I could ask the professor a question here.
Fire away.
Hey, I drive a truck, and when my father was alive, we bought a couple of trucks, and we used to haul air freight from San Francisco to L.A., L.A. to San Francisco. And one day, you know, he always would try to show me, you know, I broke down one day, so he came over and he says, "Now watch this," but I was young at the time, and I wouldn't concentrate on what he was telling me. I was thinking about girls and different things, you know, and so he passed away, and then I'm going to L.A., and I decided to sell my truck and keep his for, you know, because, I don't know, you know. He passed away. It was about a week later. I'm going down to L.A., and my truck breaks down, and I think it was the same exact problem when I broke down earlier, you know, a few years ago. And I had a cab over, so I lifted up the cab and got in there when I, you know, up on the same area. And I look up in the air and I says, "Pop, man, help me out." I had no idea, you know. He tried to teach me, but I couldn't remember anything. And all of a sudden, something came over me. And within minutes, I made the truck, I fixed the truck, in other words, but I had to get a part, but I could shut off the truck, and I could start the truck, but the only way I could shut the truck off, and I remember him saying, you know, take the clutch off. And within minutes, I don't know what, you know, felt kind of strange to me, but I fixed the truck, and I made it all the way down to L.A., you know, to LAX.
All right, and so you think your dad instructed you?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. It sounds like your dad stepped in and provided you with what you needed to know.
Right. So is this a fairly common occurrence? Certainly it has been on our phone lines so far.
You know, people have communications from deceased loved ones all the time. I have people coming up to me when they find out who I am, what I do. They tell me stories that they absolutely don't tell their spouses or family members because they think that everybody's going to think they're crazy. And I hear from so many people. I mean, it's just absurd how many people tell me stories who have not told them to anybody else, that it makes me think that if we could actually get people to talk about this for a change honestly instead of being afraid of ridicule,
that we find that a huge, not just a small percentage, not a medium percentage, but a huge percentage of the American public has had some kind of experience we consider extrasensory or psychic or paranormal. And it wouldn't be, it wouldn't be paranormal. It would be a very normal experience, maybe a rare one, but a normal experience for that matter.
Well, I know they do surveys on this kind of thing from time to time.
Yeah.
Are surveys beginning to show that attitudes are changing?
Well, you know, the surveys have always shown that people have had a belief in this subject, and it goes up and down. It depends on the population that they're actually surveying for the time. But college-educated people tend to believe more in ESP than non-educated people, and which is an interesting thing in and of itself, considering so many of them
Yeah, that's a wow. That's a definite wow. You would think
somebody
the other way around.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, there are other surveys that have been done in terms of belief in life after death. That cuts across all strata of economics and education, and even in people having had experiences, it cuts across. And the experience level has been about 38%, between 32% and 38% of people saying that they've had some sort of encounter with the afterlife. You know, whether it's a deceased loved one or something else. So that's a pretty high percentage. It's been pretty consistent across the boards.
Do you know the name Matthew Alper?
It sounds vaguely familiar, but
okay. He wrote a book called "The God Part of the Brain."
Okay.
His contention is that our brains provide us with the need with God and the need to worship because of our innate fear of our mortality.
Sure, and that's you can kind of go that way with anthropology too, that we have a need for divinity and a need for an afterlife because we don't want to think this is the end. But that doesn't necessarily, you know, saying that may be true, but that doesn't negate the possibility there actually is an afterlife.
There you go. You're on the air. Let's see. This would be Kevin in Connecticut.
Yes, hello, Art. I'm listening on my old black and white television tonight.
Wait a minute. How would you be listening to us on black and white TV?
Well, the professor suggested that our bodies are like old dad televisions.
Okay.
Evan was kind enough to let me ask two questions. I might slip in a third if I'm really good. First question, are we maybe, and I say we, those of us who honor and believe in the subject matter you're talking about, Professor, are we maybe shooting ourselves in the foot with phrases like paranormal and supernatural? Drop the super, drop the peril.
Yeah.
This is study of what's natural. This is study of what's in front of us every day and normal.
You hit a nail on the head. We've been trying to figure out a new name for the field of parapsychology for a very long time. We can't come up with anything without having to explain people what we used to be. And I think it's a problem of, you know, if we had Madison Avenue advertisers behind us to create a campaign so we could say it's no longer the paranormal, everything's now normal, we'd be cool. We'd be fine. Years ago, I worked on a game show called Telepathy, which made it as far as being bought by the game show network, and then they changed regimes, and the new guy said, no, don't want to do that. But it was set up in such a way that there was actually a couple of psychic tasks, a couple of experiments, or real ESP things that people could do, and people were doing it in our run-throughs. They were doing really well, and my feeling was that as soon as you make it a daily game show, it's normal.
Yeah, good point. kind of like government shutdowns and budget crises.
Right.
Sorry, I hit him in the sore spot. Second question, has there ever been any thought of a group of folks amassing whatever it would take, several $100 million or whatever, to start a college or a accredited university that would honor this field of study?
Good question.
Well, we need the money. There are many universities that probably, if you offer them the right amount of money, and you didn't make the money contingent on, you know, only going to the new department. I had an interesting conversation with some of the Pac-10 coaches years ago because my dad had produced the Rose Bowl, and I was at one of their meetings, one of their luncheons, and we started talking about parapsychology, and I asked them what it would take for, these are major universities, to get parapsychology, and they all said, okay, a lot of money, half of which goes to the football team.
There you go.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, why that? He said, because if you got the football, the athletic department supporting you, and the athletic department is important to the survival of the university, you can't go wrong. And he's kind of right. I mean, the university has to get something out of it. It can't just be $1 million to establish a chair of parapsychology. It has to be $5 million, half of which goes to the university, and the other half establishes a department. So, you know, it has to be done correctly. But we still need that angel. We need, you know, we need Sir Richard Branson to come out with the money for us, you know. He likes Mavericks. We're Mavericks.
All right. If you have a third question, drop it now.
You've been most generous. Third question, is there any evidence of any psychic connection with beings that are non-human, either animals or of other planets?
Well, definitely animals.
Yeah, I mean, people have definitely had real encounters with their ghosts of their deceased pets and such. And there's, you know, I have to take every pet psychic or animal psychic with a grain of salt, because I mean, I don't believe that my animals are thinking in complete sentences, frankly. But there definitely is. There's literature that goes back actually to the late 19th century, with animal ghosts and animal encounters and such. And there's also those incidences of animals trailing people who have moved, their owners who accidentally left them behind or on purpose left them behind across the country, and being able to show up 3,000 miles later at the new house with no, and the family flew there. You know, so there's nothing it could have followed in that way. So there's some form of psychic trailing, you might say, that's going on with that. You know, we don't know what to do about when people say that they're in communication with extraterrestrials, because we can't prove it one way or the other. There's no way for us to do anything with that.
All righty. What about evil entities?
Well, you know, maybe this is my anthropology background speaking here, but I don't believe in pure evil. People do evil things, and so there are certainly deceased people who might not have been nice in life and certainly are not anymore. There's an interesting book called The Science of Evil by Simon Baron Cohen, which takes a look at the idea of evil as a lack of empathy, as rather than a force, you know, good versus evil kind of thing. And I think it's a good way of looking at it, that there certainly are, we've had cases where the entities have been, you know, they weren't nice people when they were alive, but they're not able to affect people that much, that dramatically, except on a psychological basis. They can certainly, you know, pop up and freak people out, that's for sure.
Certainly, with a lack of empathy, any action that spirit or even person does could be regarded as pure evil.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. All right, hold it right there, Professor. We're going to take a break. Whew, and I can use it, too. I'm Art Bell. This is Dark Matter.
If you could...
Yes, it's not a trick. Just turn to Dark Matter. Hi, everybody. It's great to be with you. My guest is Professor Lloyd Auerbach. What a show, huh? You're welcome to participate. Those are the numbers, and I think it's Teresa in Pennsylvania on the air with the professor right now. Hi. Hello.
Hello. First of all, I'd like to ask the Professor Auerbach if he's any relation to the Red Auerbach family.
No, my dad knew Red Auerbach, but because they were both in sports.
Okay. No, well, my dad came out of Brooklyn on a basketball scholarship. He turned down Murderers Incorporated, invited him to work for them, and he said, "No, I have a basketball scholarship to GW." And he met Red, and they were best friends for life, you know. But at any rate, I just wondered because the name. I've only related this story one other time. I have a couple of things I'd like to tell you, but this is the most. Dynamic. My mother passed away when I was 11, and I'm in bed one night sound asleep, and something wakes me up, and there's my mother sitting on the side of the bed, and I could see her just as clear as could be, and I went to reach out to hug her, and she said, "No, you can't touch me." And for some reason, I understood. And she was talking to me and telling me that she was very sorry she had to leave, blah, 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 blah. But I'm the strong one in the family, and I'm the one who has gifts, and I have to believe in myself, blah, blah, blah. So after this conversation, which I can't remember all of it, I guess because I was 11, but she gets up to leave, and we were in a we had a Cape Cod house, and she walked to the door and started to go down the steps. And oh, I forgot to tell you, when I first saw her, I saw me get up out of me and go across the room and stand in the corner.
Oh, that's important.
Yeah, so my physical being, I think, was in the bed, but some other part of my being was across the room. So she went to go down the steps, and I started to follow her, and she said, no, you can't come after me. Don't do this. Don't do it. And I began to feel a pain, a sharp pain in my belly button, and I stopped, and as she got to the bottom of the steps, she disappeared. And I went back and got in my bed, and I saw me come back into me. Now, it so happens that I was on a date with a fellow who was with the Edgar Cayce Institute,
mm-hmm.
and I related this dream, that's what I've always referred to it as, this dream, this incident, to him. And when I turned around, because I'd been fooling with the stereo system, his jaw was like on his lap. And I said, what's the matter? And he said, Teresa, you just related the dream that's called the dream of the silver cord. And had you pursued your mother, you would have died.
Well,
have you?
I don't know.
Yeah,
that's
actually not true. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you were probably in what's called a hypnagogic state, which is a state between sleep and wakefulness. Had a real experience with your mother, but for whatever reason, the imagery of your leaving your own body was there. But out of body experiences, not everyone reports a silver cord. A lot of people have out of body experiences without that actually being there, and you wouldn't have died.
Actually, the silver cord is what keeps you connected.
It's actually, in the research, the actual research, especially by my colleague Carlos Alvarado, it's a very small percentage of people who report the silver cord, and it probably is necessary for those people to have that connector, but most people don't need it.
Safety thing?
Yeah.
That the mind requires? Okay.
Yeah.
Somebody wants me to ask you about the... a belief in transmigration, where a soul comes back as not a human but an animal.
Well, you know, if we could regress the cow or the cockroach, we might have a better idea of that. That is absolutely a belief in Hindu culture, and it's a belief in other cultures as well.
Right,
but
right.
There's nothing we can do with that. We can't really research that. You know, there's only so much you can do to see what's going on. We limit ourselves to those cases that have verifiable information. There are those kid cases that the information's not verifiable, and, you know, they're not as good cases as the ones that where we do have verifiable information, but you couldn't do it with a dog or a cat or a cow or a cockroach.
Here. Robin in Florida, you're on the air.
Art, Infinite
yes.
Roswell.
Thank you.
And 51's from Belgab.
Thank you.
Lloyd, this is Robin. And,
oh, hi, Robin.
I couldn't resist. I had to try to get through. So I've had paranormal experiences, witnessed activity, and one place in particular, which is quite amusing, is this took place in Las Vegas. I was a professional actress for years, and I was a Vulcan. It's Star Trek, The Experience.
Wow.
And so I kind of want to go over some of these experiences with you and ask you your insight on it. First of all, the ride attraction and museum is in the basement area. It's now closed, but it was in the basement. And we basically were pretty much in a web of electricity.
Mm-hmm.
We would be thoroughly exhausted when we left that night after our shift. It felt like, I mean, literally there are wires all around us, and we're in the dark. And there was always, I mean, you know, the ride, the maintenance, you know, and so forth, the sets were very elaborate for that.
I remember,
whole,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the transporter room alone, just an entire room lifting up on an electrical grid up into the ceiling. And so you know, we joke we're under that we're in a battery, and there are always odd occurrences happening. Like with the we had transit doors that, you know, did the shoot shoot shoot. You know, when you would go from the transporter room into the transit quarter onto the bridge, and they would sometimes close and open on people. And you know, we're sitting around in between shows in our Starfleet outfits and, you know, Borg and Ferengi, just kind of bored. And we started to play games with it, you know, with yes or no questions. And first of all, you're working with performers, and I try to explain to people, artists, performers, dancers already work on the understanding of the suspension of disbelief.
Right.
Every stage in theater has a ritual. We're working in the unimaginable, so we're already open. And as physical performers that, you know, do yoga and we care for our body like instruments, we're already very intuitive because we're working in that realm, whether you're painting or you're writing a script. And then you consider the script of Star Trek and are adopting that truth to our characters. And not everyone there was a crazy Trekkie fan. In fact, they really didn't want to cast any of that kind of personality. You know.
All right. Well, I'm going to almost have to call time on you here, hon. We don't have a lot of time.
Okay. So there were times where three or four performers did see a female ghost way along in the back of the ride while they were doing renovation as a part of the hotel. And I do believe it was probably a recording. I myself, in between a show, was standing next to a fellow actor. I got a whiff under my nose. It smelled like a dog. And I glanced quickly and saw the outline and described the dog to her. And it was her dog that passed away that she grew up with. So I'm just curious what components here I'm touching on, you know, that's participating in these experiences for us.
Okay.
Well, you know, the electromagnetic cage is essentially what you're in. There's been some research that shows electromagnetic fields can cause people to have hallucinations. That's the work of Michael Persinger. And it affects us in different ways. For multiple people to see the same thing, there's also an indication that electromagnetic fields might actually cause people to become more psychic. So there might have actually been a kind of ghostly visitor there or something you may have been picking up on, again, an imprint of what was in the place of the Hilton back in Vegas before the Hilton was built, another building or something else. And it just simply supercharged people's abilities to see those things. We'd have to kind of experiment with that. But that's one of the things we want to experiment with is take a look and see how electromagnetic fields do affect people in order to make them either more psychic or more likely to pick up things that are suggested to them.
All right. It says, Bram, that you're calling from Japan. Is that right?
That is true, sir.
Where in Japan are you?
I'm calling from Kumagaya. It's the hottest city in Saitama, and it's about 74 kilometers north of Tokyo.
Well, welcome to the program.
You spent some time in Japan, didn't you?
Oh, yes.
Well, never got down to Okinawa, but as they've been saying, Ippai Roosevelt Agimasu. I give you an awful lot of rocks.
You're a little difficult to understand. I guess you're on Skype, right?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay, turn your audio down just a little bit because you're distorting.
Okay, let me bump that down a bit there.
That's
okay.
Way better, yes.
Okay. So I've got a question for your guest. Okay, we all know that a ghost is supposedly the disembodied spirit of a person. But what happens for those kinds that are non-sentient? You know, the kind that seem to appear at a specific time, at a specific location, they do an action, and they disappear, and they don't interact with other people. What do you think those are? Do you think they're like a quantum echo or something like this?
That's one way of putting it. I mean, they are what we call this place memory, that somehow the environment has recorded events that people pick up in various sensory modes. Some people see them, some people hear them, some people feel things that are there. They typically can either be highly emotionally charged events or just day-to-day things that are very, very repetitive, but they are repetitive. They're basically recordings. So, you know, you can ask the question of whether something is interactive or whether something is just simply a representation of something that happened in the past.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back for a second to OBEs. Have you researched out-of-body experiences? And if so, what do you feel? Is it the real McCoy? People really are leaving their bodies?
You know, some part of people are leaving. I don't think they're completely leaving their bodies. I was involved a little bit in the research at the American Society for Psychical Research back in the early 80s. My first job in parapsychology was at the ASPR in New York, and they were doing a lot of OBE research with Dr. Carlos Osis and Alex Tanis and Donna McCormick. And, in fact, on YouTube, on my YouTube channel, if you just pop my name into YouTube, you'll actually come to a video I put up of the ASPR OBE experiment from the early 1980s. We had some video that we put up there. And it seems that some part of you leaves your body. Alex liked to talk about it as almost like a space probe. You send part of yourself out. Most of the people I've talked to who do OBE and who have been subjects in experiments have always said, if my entire spirit left my body while I'm alive, my body would die. That would be it. So they always thought of their consciousness as splitting off, of sending a different part. And sometimes they could even be in two places at once, where in Alex's case, he could actually be the observer throughout his out-of-body presence's eyes and even describe to the researchers where he was physically, what was going on at the other location, too. So it's something is going on where something seems to have a different positioning, because it does come across as very different to the experience, the person having the experience, than remote viewing does. It comes across very, very differently than just the process of remote viewing.
There was a movie about this, but my producer the other day mentioned to me that he had a dream within a dream.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was pretty unusual, and he came out of the dream and then went back to the dream he wanted to go to. That's a lot of control of dreaming.
Well, there is a thing called lucid dreaming where you're aware that you're dreaming.
Right.
And that's something, interestingly enough, that a parapsychologist first talked about and was back in 1910. Trevor von Eden talked about that. It's just one of those things that one of the people in our field talks about something, but because it came from somebody in psychical research or parapsychology, it doesn't exist. Stephen LaBerge, who was the one who made lucid dreaming a household phrase, deliberately didn't talk about the previous research that had been done in lucid dreaming by von Eden and by Celia Green and other people, because he didn't want to contaminate the possibility of it being even looked at by the rest of the scientific community. He came out after the fact and said, oh, by the way, I'm not the first guy to do this. But he very wisely, given the political climate in science, kind of kept it close to the vest.
Yes, sir. All the way up to Canada, and it's Bob. Hi, Bob.
Hey, how you doing? Mega Roswell's there, Art.
And, thank you.
A couple of Area 51s are for hallelujahs there. Anyhow, I've got a couple of stories here. One would be, I was at a truck stop one time, back in the late 90s, and a young waitress there come up to me, and all of a sudden I get this image of a man wearing glasses, dressed in a soldier's uniform, and it just so happens I questioned the girl if her dad had passed away, and sure enough, and I reminded her of him because I wore glasses, and the soldier was wearing glasses and had mentioned to me that he wanted her to take, and he said the pet name for her younger sister, back home. And back home for them was in Arkansas. I forget the name. But anyhow, I thought that was kind of unique. I've never had that experience before, and the younger sister actually did work there, and she came over and stood maybe 20 feet away, scared to death, with her mouth wide open. So I just kind of thought that was awesome to experience. And also I've had a experience with, like, when people die, I get the locks in my house switching around, lights turning on and off, and within 3 days, there's an announcement of death, like, in my family type of thing, right?
Hmm.
So it's just kind of wondering what experience that would be, like, for the spirits to come and let me know or warn me of a, you know, death, oncoming death.
Well, you know, that actually could be you. It actually could be your unconscious coming aware of some upcoming death in the family and causing those things to actually happen to kind of alert you consciously that this is happening.
Professor, have you ever wondered if people who dream of dying die?
Well, you know, I'm sure that it's possible that some people do. We know that people can kind of talk themselves into death, and people can believe themselves into death. So it's possible that people do die. But, you know, there are those statements that if you have a falling dream and you hit the ground, you're going to die.
Right.
First of all, we don't know for a fact that that doesn't happen, but I can tell you that that doesn't happen to everybody because I have had that experience in my dreams. But then again, I grew up on Looney Tunes, so I just get up out of the Lloyd-shaped hole in the ground and, you know, dust myself off and walk off.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Hold it there. We've got a break we've got to do. We're coming toward the end of it, actually, but we've still got room for calls. Oh, my. Good evening, everybody. Don't forget the website, artbell.com. Some videos up there you're going to want to see from Russia, and I'm sure that Keith is researching more. My guest is Professor Lloyd Auerbach, and welcome back. Here's a question from Valerie, Professor.
Okay.
Please ask about induced metaphysical experiences with electromagnetic fields called transcranial stimulation. A strong electromagnetic field can be used to induce experiences like abduction, religious ecstasy, and out-of-body experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's based on the work of Michael Persinger, who really kind of came up with a geomagnetic connection to psychic experience years ago. And there's some interesting work, and it's very controversial because there's a few people in the field and around Persinger's work who claim that they've tried to replicate it and haven't been able to get it to work the same way, but it's not clear that they've actually done replications. If you basically you're using a magnetic field that's similar to the Earth's magnetic field in strength. So it's not a very strong field. It's just a field of a particular type that goes into the brain at certain angles. And depending on what it hits and where it hits, you can have different types of experiences, whether it's metaphysical, near-death experience, out-of-body. But the context, the feeling of those experiences is very different and certainly don't have the veridical nature of some of these other experiences, the verifiable parts of it.
Okay. Scott in San Diego, your turn.
Hi, Art. Great show.
Thank you.
A little while ago, Lloyd mentioned the possibility of telling a relative or a friend or a spouse of your experiences.
Yeah.
And I've had a number of experiences with psychometric events where you hold an object and pick up impressions. And in the early 80s, I took a course with a psychic and learned that. And a few years later, I got married, and my new wife's wedding ring didn't fit right, so it was in the shop getting fixed. And in the meantime, she was wearing a ring that belonged to her maternal grandmother with stones representing the grandmother's children, one of whom was my mother-in-law. So I'm telling my wife about this experience in the psychic class, and she says, well, can you do that anytime you want? And I said, sure, I'll do it. So she hands me this ring that she's wearing, and I close my eyes and concentrate, and I'm picking up impressions of a white country store on stones out in the country, and another old building in a rural setting, and a piano that had sadness attached to it, and a blue and white ceramic bucket with a lid and a weight. Well, it turns out I was describing a little country store in southwest Missouri where she would go as a child when she would visit her grandmother. It was her grandmother's house that I was also describing. The piano was turned around, so the keyboard was facing a wall on like a back porch, and the sadness was related to the piano and the blue and white ceramic bucket. Apparently, they kept rat poison in it. One of my mother-in-law's younger brothers ate the rat poison and died.
Oh, boy.
So they had the piano removed from the house. And the other thing was, my wife said, the hair is standing up on my neck. And she said, how do you do that? Is there a scientific explanation for why I'm able to do this?
Well, first of all, I have to say that I've taught a lot of people psychometry. It seems to be one of the easiest things for people to learn psychically, just kind of opening up to it. And it's probably like, it's very similar to what goes on in those hauntings, in that place memory, that the fields or the structure of objects, and a house is just a big object, but they hold information about their past, where they've been, you know, not the things that they've seen, because they haven't seen anything per se, but they're almost like recording the environment in some ways, and we're sensitive if we open ourselves up to information that is in that field around that object. So it's something that people just need to be, most people can do it if they just let go of their perceptions and kind of let things just flow into their minds.
Yes, we unlearn so much.
Yeah.
Let's go to Michigan and Wes. Hi, Wes.
Hey, Art. How are you doing?
Just fine, sir.
Okay. Being that it's October, I just got to throw this out to you. I have that same issue, I guess you'd call it, with the red eyes in the dark. So you're not the only one.
I don't like red eyes. Our phone connection is not so good, so got to make it quick.
Okay, yeah, real quick, I want to ask your guest if he has had any experience with the double slit experiment, and also if he's experimented with structured water, and I'll take my answer off here.
I didn't get the first one.
The double slit experiment.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that's a physics experiment, and I haven't done anything with the double slit experiment, but Dean Radin is doing an experiment. It's a quantum effect, and he's doing a kind of consciousness on the double slit experiment, where a particle is kind of light goes through one slit or the other. It's a light pattern thing. So Radin is doing that. I'm not involved in that of that research at this point. And the other thing, now I forget the other item he said.
I had forgotten too. I thought that was a clear one. I couldn't get
structure
the first
water,
one.
Structure water.
That's it. Yeah, that's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, well, I guess you could say the closest I've come is trying. I'm working on trying to redo Dean Radin's experiment on the structure of chocolate and intention in chocolate. It's kind of the same kind of thing. The Emoto's work, which Radin and other folks have replicated, is that changing the chains of molecules in the water, so that they are strung together in very specific patterns with different emotional reactions. And there's, you know, it's been replicated, so there's something to it for sure.
Okay. Mike in California. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Great program tonight, guys.
Thank you.
Wanted to talk to Lloyd about the importance of grieving and people who don't and how it can end up destroying their life.
Yeah.
My mother and father passed within about 3 months of each other. My father was an ex-Marine, and he always said, you suck it up and you go on and you be a man about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I did. And about 18 months later, I found myself waking up about every night feeling as if I was smothered. And I was in a room, and I had to get to a window and look out. And how it manifests, I just wanted to share with the viewers, if you don't grieve, it manifests.
Well, we don't have viewers. We have radio folks here listening. But I'll tell you something. I said it earlier. If it doesn't get you now, it's going to get you later. And that's basically what you're saying.
Yes, yeah. I'd gone to the doctor. He sent me to a therapist, and the therapist sat me down and told me, if you do not grieve, it's like putting potatoes in a boiling pot. Sooner or later, it's going to boil over.
Right.
And if you don't deal with it, it can destroy you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's a really important point. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much. We're running woefully short on time here. Let's stay here in Nevada. Marion, you're on the air very quickly with Professor Auerbach.
Okay. Hi. Very nice to speak with you. Thank you. Years and years and years ago, when I was about 5, and I remember it like it was yesterday, and that's why I say years ago, because I'm 65 now, but I was awakened. I was sleeping with my 2.5-year-old sister in the same bed. It was dark, and there was somebody standing at the foot of the bed, and I saw this person from about hips up, but all I saw, it was like what you would say fiber optics. It was the outline of like a man's body. So I saw arms, shoulders, neck, head, but everything was totally dark. You could just see right through it. And it just stood there looking at me, I guess. I mean, the body was there. And at the top of the head, there were two little curved, I don't know what you'd call it, for lack of a better expression, horns that faced inward toward each other to the center of the head. And I just stood, well, I was laying there. I pulled the covers up, you know, over my nose, and I was just looking, and I didn't say a word. I was frozen. But
Marion, we're out of time. I'm sorry to say it, but we're out of time, and I've got to leave it with a horn, with horns, jeez. Horns. Professor, it has been such a pleasure having you on the air.
Thank you, Art.
I hope that we can do this again.
Sure, we sure can.
So, again, it's been my pleasure, and you have a good night, sir.
Thanks very much. You too.
Take care. Boy, what an honor. That's it, folks. We are flat out of time. Have a good night, and I will see you tomorrow. This is Dark Matter. Good night.